Order. Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Eugene Connors.
Here.
Councilmember Joan Hanson.
Here.
Councilmember Shirley Doughty.
Present.
Mayor Ronald Ortley.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Anna Klein.
Here.
Councilmember Douglas Dunn.
Here.
Councilmember Serena Sullivan.
Here.
Justin Johnson, City Manager. Nina Williams, Deputy City Clerk. Sharon Bono, Finance Director. Albert Chave, Interim Police Chief. Jack Ernest, Fire Chief. Robert Coronado, Sergeant at Arms, and Carl, City Attorney.
Thank you very much. For the invocation, we are honored tonight to have the Emeritus Senior Chaplain from the Arizona State Prison in Douglas, Mr. Kevin Donnelly.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here to lead you in this evening's invocation. You know, 20 years ago, I began to be a chaplain at the State Prison in Douglas. And after I had been there for a little while, I realized that there was, you could find palpable fear among those unfortunate guys who live in prison. We call them inmates. And the fear came from many different directions. Most of the worst fear came from other inmates who had the power to influence how their days went, how they led their lives, and even their relationships with their families. So I began to realize that it was important for these inmates to begin to develop in some way a sense of security, and I decided to start sharing with them something that I had discovered some years ago in the letter of Paul to the Romans. In the second letter, he says that when we're up against it, when we're in a tight spot, that we can always ask the Holy Spirit to pray for us, and the Holy Spirit will pray for us in words that we cannot understand, and always in accordance with God's will. So I started, when I had in front of me an inmate who I thought was ready to listen, I started talking with him about this, about the possibilities that came from this. And you know how it is when you sow a seed, you never know for a long time whether it's going to do any good. Some years after I started, actually about 10 years ago, when I was in one of the units, and an inmate came up to me and said, "Chaplain Donnelly, I wanted to thank you for what you told me some years ago." And I asked him to explain what it was that I had told him, and he told me that I suggested that he pray to the Holy Spirit and ask the Holy Spirit to pray for him, because I always explained to them that the Holy Spirit could help them to find, to be in the right places at the right time, to be able to associate with the right people and not the people who could get them into trouble. And that was very important for those guys to know about. And he told me that I should keep on talking about that, because it really worked. That was the first time I ever had someone come up to me and say that it actually worked, these words and the scriptures. And so it's in light of that experience that I would like to give this invocation this evening. Holy Spirit, we ask you to pray for us. Favor us with an equal part of your gifts. Give us especially the gift of offering with words the concerns we have in our hearts. And give us no less especially the gift of receiving these concerns into our hearts. Then give us understanding and love, so that our decisions and actions may be made in the light of the wisdom that you give us. and above all, give us the possibility of peace in our relationships. In thanksgiving for your gifts, we pray. Amen.
Chaplain Kevin Donnelly, thank you very much. We appreciate that. Let us stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have two proclamations tonight. First one is Water Awareness Month. Whereas water is one of Arizona's most vital and precious resources, and whereas Arizona is an arid state where water is scarce and population continues to increase our demand for water, and whereas all citizens of Arizona and visitors should use water more efficiently, and practicing a low water use lifestyle is a way that each individual and business can help ensure a long-term sufficient water supply. And whereas water education is a cornerstone to any comprehensive water conservation program, and greater awareness of water issues can be gained through community education, action, and celebrations. And whereas the City of Bisbee encourages water conservation this month and every month of the year, now therefore be it resolved that I, Ronald Ertley, Mayor of the City of Bisbee, Arizona, do hereby proclaim the month of April 2015 to be Water Awareness Month. In our community, encourage all citizens to pledge to continue to use water wisely this month and every month of the year. And I'd like to present this to Ms. Cato Daly.
Thank you for your efforts.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you, Mayor Ertel and the council for joining the state of Arizona in proclaiming April as Water Awareness Month. Fortunately, we're not in the same predicament as California, where the governor is requiring a 25% reduction in water consumption due to drought reducing their water supplies. However, studies indicate that if things keep going the way they are, the entire Southwest U.S. is headed for longer and more widespread droughts. So, let's stay ahead of the curve and make wise water use a lifestyle and never take water for granted. Let's celebrate, take a walk in the San Pedro River, write a poem, fix drips, plant native plants, and take special care of water as the most precious gift of life.
On behalf of the community and the council, I would like to thank you very much for all the efforts that you have done. Appreciate that. Our second proclamation tonight is a Fair Housing Proclamation. Whereas the Civil Rights Act of 1968, commonly known as the Federal Fair Housing Act and the Fair Housing Amendments Act of 1988, prohibit discrimination in the sale, rental, leasing, and financing of housing or land to be used for the construction of housing or in the provision of brokerage services on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, disability, familiar status, or national origin. And whereas the 1968 and 1988 Federal Fair Housing Acts declare that it is national policy to ensure equal opportunities in housing, and whereas April has traditionally been designated as Fair Housing Month in the United States. Now therefore, I, Mayor Ronald Ertley, do proclaim April as Fair Housing Month in the City of Bisbee and do hereby urge all citizens of this community to comply with the letter and spirit of the Fair Housing Law. Thank you. Next, we are going to go to call to the public. We'll start off with, is it L. Phillips? Okay, yeah.
I'm Larry Phillips, and I live in Warren here in Ward 2, and I happen to be a member of the Streets and Infrastructure Committee. And I just read the notice in the paper about looking for a candidate neighborhood for the block, community block grant. I'd just like to recommend Don Louie. It has all, meets all criteria, and it's got some special features that if they can get the block grant for that area, it has perpendicular right angle turns, big wide easements, it would really benefit that area. And I just came here for this reason, to throw it out there so somebody will consider.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Next, we have Peter Von Gundlach.
Council, Mayor, thank you for the opportunity. One of the things that I've been noticing lately, and I'm offering this as a question simply because I don't know, is that in my research and attempting to put together a cost-benefit analysis of our wastewater treatment plant as well as the solar plant, I've noticed that the electric bill is no longer included in the agenda package. So as of December, the numbers which used to be somewhere between $6,000 and $9,000 every month for the electric bill is no longer available. And I've searched, and of course, being an old guy and my eyesight isn't good, it's very likely that I missed something. But after, you know, in 3 months, we should have continued the same record keeping and transparency to the public, showing exactly how much we're spending. Of course, I've also submitted public document requests for the bills from January through March, and I've been told that they're not available. Yet, on the other hand, with a conversation with our mayor, I got the impression that we did have a bill for March that was somewhere in the $4,400 category. If that's the case, just so we all have a heads up as to where we stand on this whole issue, the $4,400 times 12 comes out to $52,800. And then we do have an irrevocable responsibility to WIFA, paying them $80,000 a year to service the loan. So if you add $80,000 to $52,800, we end up with an amount of somewhere around $133,000. Comparing that to our best billing, which was in the low 80s and the high $70,000, it looks as if we're going to be paying $50,000 more every year for the privilege of being able to brag about having a solar project or solar-powered electric. But it's not benefiting us, and I'm wondering when the next shoe will fall, which would be, of course, an increase in our sewer rates. And that could happen at any particular time, particularly after the money starts adding up. We're talking basically about paying an extra $1 million a year in fees and costs over what we are now paying now. In other words, if you look at the $50,000 difference times 20 years, that's $1 million. So we're going to be paying over 20 years an additional $1 million instead of saving money in the process. So I'm kind of curious about that. And hopefully we can find an answer, because I don't know why these numbers are not being displayed so the public has access to them. It certainly doesn't sound like open government to me at this particular point. So that's number one. Number two, I'm still rather bothered by the fact that we are prioritizing hauling recycled material around and want to have brand new pickup trucks for that purpose. And I know that the answer to that is that this is some kind of an enterprise fund and it deserves to be rewarded. Well, in my opinion, the ambulance service and our fire department should be given the opportunity to upgrade their equipment, particularly when we have vehicles that have over 300,000 miles on them. This thing shouldn't be an isolated restriction just because someone was successful in marketing our waste products. The necessity and strategic necessity of having good operating pickup trucks to haul trash, I think, comes a lot lower on the priority scale than having well-functioning ambulances and having equipment that demonstrates our support for our first responders and our fire department. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Von Gundlach. I believe that takes care of call to the public. Anybody else? No. Item number one, accounts payable. Do we have a motion?
I move that we pay accounts payable in the amount of $584,919.99.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any comments? No comment. We have a motion and a second to approve accounts payable in the amount of $584,919.99. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number two, approval of the consent agenda, items A through D, and I will read those. Approval of the minutes of the regular session of the mayor and council held on February the 3rd, 2015 at 7 p.m. B, approval of the appointment of Keith Bogues to the Board of Adjustments with a waiver of number of commissions served. C, approval of the park facility and right-of-way use permit for the Bisbee Farmers Market for use of Lower Vista every Saturday to begin April 2015 through April 2016. And D, approval of a special event liquor license application submitted by the Douglas Arts and Humanities Association for an event to be held at 22 Brewery Avenue, Saturday, April the 25th, 2015, and Saturday, May 23rd, 2015, from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve the consent agenda items A through D.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any comments? No comments. We have a motion and a second. Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hanson?
Aye.
Councilmember Dowdy?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Earley?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number three, discussion of a memorandum of understanding agreement and the intergovernmental agreement for automatic assistance between the City of Bisbee Fire Department and the Palominas Fire District. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor, members of the council. I want to take a minute to introduce Chief Mark Matthews of Palominas Fire District and Chief Ernest. We're kind of jump this thing and jump right in. So if you want to come on up to the podium. The automatic aid agreement is very, very much consistent with how many communities across the country operate. You know, one of the greatest benefits that we can have as first responders is redundancy and backup and support. We already have a mutual aid agreement when there's an incident and we need assistance. Upon request, we'll get assistance from our neighbors, fire, you know, police, whatever the case may be, in our surrounding communities. But in this case, I mean, if there's an incident, that automatic aid actually kicks right in. And so, you know, I want to take a minute, just turn it over to Chief Ernest, who'll jump right in and kind of give some details. We did have an opportunity to meet collectively as a group. Chief Matthews came over and we sat over in the shop and really chopped up the document and talked about a couple of items. And there's still a few legal issues that we will need to rectify, but this is discussion only, and we'll bring the final document back to you all at our next meeting. So with that said, Chief, I'll turn it over to you.
Chief Ernest.
Some time ago, Chief Matthews from Palomino has contacted me and brought up an idea, not a new idea because he has other mutual aid or automatic aid agreements with the Pratt Fire Department. Tried to put together a kind of a legal document that just identifies ways that we can assist each other under certain circumstances and incidents. We have a draft that's been put together that kind of describes and identifies what our portion of this will be and Palomino's will be. One thing we want to remember is a lot of this stuff that's identified here is already being done, whether within our CON or the way we respond anyway. It just kind of outlines it and actually puts things in perspective on how we will do that. We do have a portion here under limitations where it says if we just don't have the people or the vehicles, whether it's us or Palominas, and we can't respond, we just can't respond. And I think that's the important thing that's in there because, as we all know, we stay very busy on a daily basis and run a lot of calls. And whether it's Palominas or Bisbee, being requested, sometimes you just don't have the availability of people or vehicles to do that. So I was happy with that. That was in this MOU. So, but he can probably, the chief from Palominas probably can talk about it a little more. It came from his shop. They're the ones that put this together. Maybe he can describe some of the important parts of this. We can hear from him.
Okay. Mr. Mark Matthews, Palominas Fire District Chief.
Well, it's very lovely to be over here tonight. Nice to see all the folks in this meeting. I'm not used to having this many folks in a district meeting, so this is awesome. An auto aid agreement, there's two facets of an auto aid agreement. This is, as the chief alluded to, this is not the first time I've worked on an auto aid agreement. Where I came from before, it was a very, very common way of doing business. And we have an auto aid agreement with this Fry. Our organization has one with Fry, Sierra Vista, and the Coronado National Forest for emergency response as it relates to medical, fire, and anything ingest related with rescue and things like that. The first part of it is an intergovernmental agreement, and that's the part that you bring to the
your council or your district board, and that's the basis of the legal, for lack of better words, mumble jumble that you have to actually go through, so we know who's got whose liability factors everything responds as we're responding. So if we're coming over to Bisbee to assist that, we assume all the liability. What the intergovernmental agreement says is that we're coming over, our workman's comp, we have our people employed under workman's comp, all the things that your Arizona re-advised statutes require, we have. Same thing for the city of Bisbee, that's the agreement that they're keeping those standards up. So in case we do have something unfortunate happen, that the liability factor falls on that organization, and not that they're looking for the deeper pockets and coming back after somebody. So it's all in that sense. And it's basically what we need to get the ball rolling. And with the approval of the council and a board of directors, and then the memorandum of agreement, or in the MOU, memorandum of understanding, is basically when the chief and I get together and we put together our operational needs and in certain areas. That way it doesn't have to come to the council every time something happens. If we build another station or we shut a station down or things change with the other organization, then it's just operational functions to help provide a better service for the community. The reason we do water aid agreements is as the ever-changing times are in the fire service, there's more and more asked of us and less of us. And it's a big family. We train together. That's the number one part that's really great about an auto aid agreement, is that we equally can share training back and forth and help one another out, and expenses, trying to share the expenses and the costs. But for the most part, it allows for us to be an efficient service throughout the southern Cochise area. Bisbee being out here kind of an island on their own in some respects, it helps to have auto aid agreements, so those organizations, when things do happen, we're coming to help. There's not a delay in that help. They don't have to get there and go, oh my gosh, it's terrible, now call them. As soon as the call comes in certain areas, those resources will already be on their way. So time is of importance. Yep, any other questions?
Any questions from the council or council member Klein?
Mr. Matthews, I don't know why we're doing an auto aid if we have a mutual aid. And the other question I have is, your equipment will be fine in Ward 2 and 3, but in Old Bisbee, we do have specially built equipment to maneuver, and I have concerns that your equipment will not fit in the area.
Well, those concerns were put to rest a few weeks ago when everyone told the new fire trucks that we have are too big to go up there. I personally drove them up there. The thing is to understand fire apparatus equipment and things like that. I don't believe you actually purchased, in my opinion, special needs equipment for those areas. Those areas are extremely dangerous, to be honest with you. We have vehicles that are set for that, our Type 3 engines and our brush rigs, which I know you don't even have a Type 3. So our Type 3 will easily fit up there. All our Type 1 engines, which are larger ones, will also go up there. And they're all fairly brand new. So.
Okay. And so you didn't get stuck up on OK Street?
Nope.
And you brought...
Did I scratch my fire engine a little bit because there was a vehicle in the way and I didn't feel comfortable with the side drop-off, but I don't know what that road's engineered for the weight limit? Yes. It was just a little light that got broke. In the history of business is also the medic units and their fire engines have had to push vehicles out of the road and has damaged their own vehicles, which are even smaller than that engine, on the responses also up there. And what was your other question?
I help me understand why we need auto aid. I think training together is great, but I just don't understand why we have to go auto aid. Because if my understanding is correct, you said that when dispatch goes out, they will also dispatch Palominas at the same time that we're dispatched.
In certain areas, yes.
Okay, well, what's the criteria?
The chief and I would find out what would be best for your area and also what's best for our area. Primarily in structure fires or high-risk impact type of incidents like motor vehicle accidents or for the sake of a helicopter or accident or something like that. Let me explain to you the difference between a mutual aid and auto aid. There's an enormous difference. The county mutual aid agreement is not worth the paper it's actually drawn up on, just to give you information on that. I've been a Type 1 and a Type 2 incident manager. throughout and responded to natural disasters in the nation. The first thing that I walk in and do after I do a declaration of authority is I ask for their mutual aid paperwork. And at the bottom of that, it says at any point in time, if that an organization can opt out, that piece of paper is not worth its weight in gold or anything. And the reason is that means they can just say, today we're not coming, just for the sake of we just don't like it, we're not coming. That's not good business, and that's not how we need to know things. Auto aid agreements is an agreement between two entities that say, hey, we're coming. Okay, the only reason we're not coming is because everything's all hell's breaking loose at our organization, and we can't come. So that's almost a guaranteed factor that in this small area down here, we know that we have more assistance coming our way, and you know that you have assistance coming your way. Mutual aid means you have to normally get there and say, hey, maybe we should send somebody. Auto aid is an agreement between two operational chief officers who sit down and say, in these areas and these high-risk things that could occur, we're going to have folks coming. Now, on your day-to-day medical emergencies that they're dealing with, most likely not unless they've already been, all your resources have been exhausted and you need that help. Then that would be mutual aid.
Well, I think in the history of our department, anytime we've had anything, you know, catastrophic or a big call, our mutual aid has always been there. I mean, we've never had a problem with Sanjo or Naco Fire saying, hey, we're not responding. They are there as quick as they possibly can be. And I know that, you know, we've even sent help down to Douglas for one of their really big fires. If we have the personnel and we have the equipment, that's never been a problem in this area of one of our other departments saying we're not going to back you up.
So my comment to that is please read your mutual aid agreement, because none of it says that you have to follow NFPA standards and your firefighters and your personnel are not trained to those standards. An auto aid agreement points out that you have to take those responsibilities, liabilities. When you're asking for auto aid with those folks, I would caution you to know that you're getting certified and well represented under the legal system, firefighters and NFPA qualified individuals. So that's what an auto aid agreement deals with is. We're gonna train equally, we're gonna do for the National Fire Protection Agency standards and all the standards set forth by Arizona Re-Advised Statutes. I do not believe, and I'm not gonna comment on those agencies, but I do believe that there's a lot of agencies in that mutual aid agreement that we will not participate with because they don't meet those standards. And that's a liability factor that you would have to look at if you're willing to take that risk.
Any other questions from the council?
Mayor?
Councilmember
Just
Dunn.
Clarification. It says here that we would be responding, I mean, the Bisbee Fire Department to any fires, any structural and non-structural fires in a geographic area that's described here, mile post 248. I'm assuming that must be more or less on Hereford Road. Is that junction of Hereford Road and 92?
No. 247 is actually Fowdy Road, and 248 is just outside of that area just a little bit.
Help me understand where that is. It's west of Hereford Road exit, or?
No, it's east of Hereford Road, and it's west of.
I mean east, that's right.
340.
It's 340,
not 248.
It should be, sorry.
Mapo's 348.
And that's just the MOU. That's just to give you guys an idea of what some of the conversations that would go between us on what areas that we feel were high risk in those situations. And for another example, that a lot of that area out there is unprotected and they're not paying taxes. And just this last board meeting, we have a, sorry for laughing, can you help me out here? Basically for those services, if we come out, we'll cost recovery program. So if you know, those folks that don't pay taxes out in that area know that we're going to come. I'm sure if the chief is called, the last thing we want to do. But unfortunately, the city of Bisbee and the taxpayers for Palomino's Fire District are funding the fire departments. And then those folks are not paying their tax or any income into those type of resources. So as of our last board meeting, we developed a 20-page document on cost recovery programs, which is recognized by the Arizona Fire Marshals Association and throughout the state of Arizona. So when we do go out in those areas and we're requested by not even just you or those organizations or those homeowners, they will actually have to abide by the cost recovery program that's been adopted.
Okay, just for the clarification of the geographic area then, you say milepost 348, which is somewhere west of Wilson Road. to the San Pedro River, but also then says Palominos Road. Palominos Road is west of
Palominos Road at Hereford, which is also would be east of the San Pedro River. Basically, Bisbee's CON is the San Pedro River, the dividing line, and everything east of that. So that's just basically including where their normal medical response would be, but also the fire response. The other side, we get assistance from Frye Fire District and Sierra Vista. Mm-hmm.
Palominos Road is not on the west side of the San Pedro River?
You're correct. It would be the San Pedro River. Does it give a little better geographical design?
Well, it says here, it's confusing me. It says, and Palominos Road.
Can you give me which section you're on?
Well, it's the first page, the under amount and type of assistance, the second, third paragraph.
Mayor, if I can.
Councilmember Klein.
There is an old Palominos Road and a Palominos Road. Old Palominos Road is closer to Foudia Road, then Palominos Road is just like right by the old school there and where the old post office was. So that might be the confusion. There's Palominos Road and Old Palominos Road. The Old Palominos goes over the bridge.
To be perfectly honest, we both have two different MOUs that we've been working on, so this is different than ours. And that the MOU is not what I know that I was brought here to talk about, because that's what he and I would sit down and discuss, and the intergovernmental agreement is giving us permission to basically get started in moving in those roles. Because the last thing I want is my fire board and the city council sitting down and trying to go over what we professionally do for a living, and that's emergency and fire response and operations areas. And we would be getting our times and our dispatches and everything. The ones that we sent over were primarily just rough drafts for ideas so we could discuss it.
Councilmember Dunn, did you have further?
Yes. The Palominos Fire District covers area on the east side of the San Pedro River.
Does the fire district cover?
Include.
We cover all the way up. Our fire response area covers up to milepost 247 and a very narrow area on Highway 92 to milepost 248. We've just now entered an agreement that we cover all the way up the non-incorporated areas all through that entire area that are not in Bisbee's, Naco's, San Jose's, or anyone's areas.
That's part of your tax district? You're
all the way to milepost 247 and the narrow chute down.
Because you're confusing me. You're saying now 348 and it's 247
sorry,
three, is,
three,
huh?
Three, I'm sorry. It's 347.
So in essence, it's almost all the way to Wilson Road, then. It's part of the...
I think we're a good 5 or 6 miles away from where
Right. But I mean, in that vicinity, that's... But that is part of the Palominos Fire District.
Correct. Realize there's no district. Nobody has any district boundaries between Wilson Road and milepost 248. Just raise your hand when I say
Chief Ernest, what's our response rate if we had a structural fire on the San Pedro 92 or on Hereford Road at the bridge on the San Pedro? What's our response time to that location?
Depending on the time of day, you know, it could probably be anywhere from 10, 12 minutes, maybe running code 3. It depends, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning you're in bed or if you're up and about ready to jump in the truck. So.
And vice versa then, what would be the response time from the station in Palominos to Old Bisbee?
Well, currently we're opening up our second station and we're working on opening up the third one, but we have career staff at station 193, and I'm debating whether we're going to open up station 191 first or station 192. So if we're coming from either one of those stations, the time is equal to Bisbee. Is from the Miracle Valley station is 16 minutes, and from the Palomino station is between 10 and 12 minutes also.
To Old Bisbee, I guess you're going.
Oh, I'm sorry, Old Bisbee, and I'm talking, that would be to the fire station that's on Highway 92. That's the times that I've been working. So whatever your time is from station 81, from station 181 to Old Town, you can add that on to that area.
Yeah, I forget that you're moving faster than the speed limit than what I drive that area. That's correct, yes.
Just a little bit.
Any other?
Thank you.
Councilmember Klein.
This is for our chief. I'm a little concerned, Chief, that because of our personnel issues, I know that we're probably down, what, maybe three positions from when Captain Busk was there. And given the amount of inter-facility transfers that we do, I'm extremely concerned about personnel. And, you know, we tried to get an ambulance ordered several weeks ago, and this council didn't approve it. So I'm just concerned about our vehicle and our personnel issues.
Well, I can reassure you that, and I'll be talking with the chief more about this, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit before. You know, we stay very busy, and there's just a lot, sometimes we're not going to be able to do this. And, you know, though it's an automatic aid, our first and foremost thing is to protect the city limits. And not only the citizens are busy, but the safety of our personnel. You know, I can't go below staffing and be safe. And he's aware of that. He knows the NFA, NFPA requirements and recommendations and safety stuff. We can't either, and we don't expect each other to do that, you know, that stuff. This just is a vehicle to be able to provide that kind of service. And I can say, for a number of years, even before Chief Matthews was inbound me as the chief prior to him, a couple chiefs before him, you know, when we run medical calls all the way to the river, they respond now. And it's the best thing ever, because we get extra hands on scene. And, you know, whether it's two or three people, or three or four people, you know, a lot of times they get there before us, and it's a really good thing. It gives us those hands that we need. And we want to continue to do that. Whether we consider that, you know, or this a way to make that certain that it's going to happen, I don't, you know, we can talk about how we're going to do it, but we need to continue to do that, at least for our help. Because, you know, you get on scene and you have three people, you got a vehicle accident with two vehicles head on with four patients, it's nice to have three or four more hands on scene to do that. And so, this kind of reinforces that part of it anyway. The fire part of it, we're going to be talking more about it and see how we can provide that, you know. We certainly have a big fire load in Bisbee, we know that, especially up in Oakland. And we don't want to take a chance of depleting our services so that we're in jeopardy for that. And he understands that because, you know, it's two different worlds out here where we're at and where they're at out there. So.
And you know, I can appreciate that on a motor vehicle accident. The extra hands, and I know that we do meet at the river there. I'm concerned with us going further out and then having, you know, if we have something in town, having to turn around and come back in. But I also have concerns with, we've all talked about the overtime and, you know, things like this for our guys. Who picks up the bill if we have to send our units out?
Well, if we call people in to be able to cover the city, if you send a unit out of town, of course, we would be responsible for paying for the overtime. And that's just doing business. That's what we have to do. You know, I don't think it's going to happen very often, but it's just a way to secure a working relationship with another agency. I feel strongly about it, and I think it'll work okay. But I think what it is as long as we understand how we can make this work right for both agencies and not cut ourselves short, I think that's the main thing. You know, because it's always good to have extra hands, whether it's fire or EMS.
Okay, thank you.
I want to. Are you done, Councilman? Okay. I want to clarify.
Can I address just the power man side of that? Just real quick.
Sure.
I wanted to. You were also
Chief Matthews.
What it was going to cost. City of Bisbee, but also in retrospect, when we send our folks over, we're immediately getting called back and they're coming in, so we're covering those costs. So you're also getting our resources for free at the same respect. And when you're looking at the standards of doing rescue and suppression, first and foremost, the NFPA standard is two in and two out before you can even start going into a house. And the safety issues on the fire ground are enormous. And if you're willing to take on those risks and those liabilities by not following those, you get folks like us that come in as experts and tell you should have. And then on the rescues, just to give you an example, we carry three sets of JAWS extrication tools on three pieces of equipment. We have heavy duty, medium JAWS, and lightweight JAWS. JAWS fail you. Extrication equipment fails you. It's always nice when you're out there to have those pieces of equipment on it. Recently, the city of Benson just took 3 hours to rescue an individual who eventually died inside of their site. That's going to be enormous coming up, because there were heavy rescue equipment available to them a lot quicker than that. So that's why good auto wait agreements, good programs like that, ensure that we get the right equipment, the tools there, and personnel to help everybody get the thing done.
I wanted to just clarify something that Councilmember Klein mentioned. The council did not reject buying the new ambulance. We tabled it, and I can promise you that it will be on the agenda real soon. Any other comments or questions from the council?
Mayor, I just want to echo what Councilman Klein has indicated. Certainly, we're moving into a very tight budget season coming up. This document does say that we will respond to all structure and non-structural fires, as well as motor vehicle accidents on interstate. That certainly is a significant obligation. I can certainly see the benefit to us and to them for doing that. It still is who pays, certainly if citizens wish to come forward in terms of covering that cost, I'm for it. But that certainly is what the budget discussion is going to be about. What level of service do citizens desire?
Mayor, if I can just comment.
City Manager Justin Johnson.
One of the things that I want to make sure we keep at the forefront of our minds is that we're formalizing an already existing practice that we're already doing. And the other key component of all of this is the opportunity to partner with an adjoining agency for training purposes as well. And so that's a key component as we talk about budget and the realities that we have. Quite frankly, Palominas has a really nice training facility there, and if we have the established relationships with these outside agencies, and in this case Palominas, we have the opportunity to further discussions and conversations about jumping in on their training schedule when opportunities do come up. And so, but that's the one thing I want to keep in mind, we're formalizing something that we're already doing anyway. We had an incident here last week. There's a cardiac patient and both agencies got together. And so, but I just want to make sure to throw that out.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the council? Council Member Sullivan.
For Chief Ernest. With this, we would always have at least one engine available in town. We would never send out all of our engines. Is that correct?
I'd like to have two engines.
Right.
there is some places in Bisbee where you have to need a pump to be able to get water to certain places, and it takes more than one engine to do that. So, yeah, we can. And that's what I said earlier on. We're not going to jeopardize the city limits of people from Bisbee or our safety of our personnel. We cannot do that.
Thank you.
And Council Member Klein.
Just for Mr. Johnson, I understand, and believe me, I appreciate the joint training. I know that makes it very affordable for us and for them, and I really appreciate that. And I think we have a good agreement an understanding right now. I'm just really concerned with the auto aid inserted in there.
And this is discussion only for today. We're not asking for approval, vote up or vote down, or whatever the case may be. So this is discussion only. So this is good conversation and dialogue. And as we go back, the chiefs and I will sit down and have discussion and chop up what we talked about tonight and come back with more information. And it sounds like that's what's needed. And I'm certainly welcome to any emails, questions, additional concerns that we can put together and perhaps lay to rest, and it can be the decision of Mayor and Council if we want to move in this direction.
Any other questions, comments, suggestions from the Council? Chief Ernest, Chief Matthews, thank you very much. Item number 4, discussion of possible approval to extend a public right-of-way use permit for lunches at Gore Park for Dan Maldonado for 1 year, effective April the 7th, 2015 to April the 7th, 2016. Mr. Tom Klimak, City of Bisbee Public Works Director.
Tuesday and Friday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. These lunches are served to the homeless and to the poor for free, no charge. I would like to request the permit be approved for 1 year, commencing April 7th, 2015 to April 7th, 2016. Public Works Department is recommending that this take place, that this permit be approved for 1 year. Mr. Maldonado has come in now twice quarterly, and it just seems like that's the right thing to do. Rather than keep coming back every quarter requesting the same permit, it's a tremendous service to the community.
Any questions, comments from the council? We have a motion? Council member Dowdy.
Thank you. Where do the lunches come from? Do they come from local restaurants or?
I think they're prepared right there on site. And they're not, because I've been there during those periods, and I'm not actually sure where they come from. I do know that
I can comment on that. The lunches are prepared by different restaurants and also different individuals. So just every week it depends on who's putting it together, which day. It's kind of just a community effort.
So they are fresh. They're not that's been sitting for
days. No, they're fresh, and I've partaken many times. Yeah.
I heard some people the other day say that they were really good.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, this lady says, go over and get you some lunch.
Uh-huh.
I said, no, thank you. She was really sincere about it. And she thought I needed to eat or something. It's pretty cute.
Mayor,
I just want to acknowledge that I had a conversation with Mr. Maldonado, and I misinformed him. I was sure this was part of our consent agenda, as it normally things like this are, and I'm sure he would have been here tonight if I hadn't assured him that this was a consent agenda and automatically approved. So I apologize to him and council for that.
Any other questions or comments from the council? I just want to say thank you to Mr. Maldonado. Things like this, which is important thing, defines who we are as a community. Do we have a motion?
I will make a motion.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I move that we approve to extend the public right-of-way use permit for lunches at Gore Park for Dan Maldonado for 1 year, effective April 7, 2015 to April 7, 2016.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Klinak.
Item number 5, public hearing on the designation of certain portions of the Tintown area as slum or blight areas in need of redevelopment or on the redevelopment plan.
Mr. Justin Johnson, City Manager.
Thank you, Mayor. This item and the next couple of items, we'll have Karina Carvajal to come up and talk in more detail with this particular item is in the public hearing, and so with that said, I'll
turn it on over.
Ms. Carbajal.
I'm going to open this public hearing. I'm going to ask, is there any discussion by members of the public in support of the items? I'm going to ask if there's any discussion by members of the public in opposition to the item. I'm going to ask the city clerk if there is any written communication filed with the city clerk's office.
Yes, sir. We had two separate phone calls, one from Maria Gonzalez and one from Gloria Brill, wished to voice their support in the Tintown project, and however, they weren't able to attend.
Thank you. If there is no further comment.
Mayor Phillips also expressed his opinion open to the call of the public. I believe this is related to this, right?
That would connect,
right.
Yes. We'll make note of that to the city clerk's office on that. Thank you for bringing that up. Councilmember Klein.
I'm sorry, who was that?
Yeah.
Larry.
Larry Phillips.
He said that would be the Don Lewis area, mm-hmm. not
That's
town.
Right. But I thought to clarify for me that the public hearing is noticed Did it say specifically regarding Tin Town, or did it say identifying?
Tin Town.
Strictly Tin Town.
Yeah. Well, newspaper article that was in the review said nothing about Tin Town. Didn't mention any neighborhood specifically. That if it would have said Tin Town, I wouldn't be here. But Don Louie just popped up in my mind through firsthand knowledge of the situation.
Ms. Carbajal and or Ms. Carl, let's maybe get a clarification on this.
But the public, CDBG is a program that the city receives funding for depending on the project. We began that procedure back in November of last year. There was public notification in November and December for public hearings and in October for input hearings. And then the final decision was made in January. So after January, the decision was made by council to select Tin Town. So after that, the publication, so to open a public hearing on the resolution to change for slum of life. The advertisement should be for the slum of life. And that's what it is about, slum of life, redevelopment area in Tin Town specifically. So I'll go look at that paper.
Well, I have no problem with Tin Town at all. It's fine. I just thought that Don Louie has got some really neat features that would really enhance it if you could give CDBG grant for Don Louie.
And in about 2.5 years, we'll be starting this process again, and please come to those meetings. Because the first meeting I had for the CDBG, I was basically the only one
there. Okay, well, I'm a member of the Streets and Infrastructure Committee, and originally.
Would you like to come up to the podium and state your name?
Yes, I'm Terry Chambers. I have a house in Tin Town. So about 2 weeks ago, I got a letter, which unfortunately I took the wrong file with me, so I don't have a letter. But it said that, as I understand it, Tin Town has been designated a slum and white area, and that funds were going to be available, I don't know about whom, to help make improvements. And so, of course, I have many questions, which is why I'm at the meeting. What does it mean when you're a slum and blight area? What will be the consequences for the availability of assistance for homeowners there? Who qualifies? Who doesn't? I mean, I once lived in a place where they rotted the bulldozer and wiped out my shop and my whole business overnight without telling anything. So, not that that's, I imagine that what's going on here is going to be exactly the opposite, where the people who have homes there, live there, will get assistance and can express what they think about what could be done and so on. Someone did mention to me that the roads would probably be chip sealed as, which are now dirt, as part of this process. But in other words, I'm here just because I don't know anything about what this means, and I want to know, and if you have anything all printed up that tells us what it is, what can happen, and what kind of assistance might be available. It's mentioned something about assistance to low-income households, maybe to help clean up their property or to fix things. I don't know. So I don't know if I have lots of questions, but that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Let me have Ms. Carbajal come back up just for a moment.
Thank you.
I had a conversation with Ms. Carbajal probably late last week, and we discussed the term of slum and blight, and that is a, correct me if I'm mistaken, that is a terminology used by the federal government.
It's a terminology used by the federal government. There's a lot of procedures that can happen in a redevelopment area. This specific one is targeting the roads that were approved by council to be able to be changed. Targeting a specific area, the slum and blight redevelopment area, allows for it to qualify. The city of Bisbee doesn't qualify as a whole because it does not meet the criteria required by CDBG. So in order for any one specific area, it would have to meet certain qualifications. One of it being that the infrastructure, some parts of the infrastructure would need to be at least 25% of it would need to be changed or need to be enhanced, improved, or something like this. We find that during our process of trying to find certain areas, we were limited to what was suggested came down to the 10-town road. So the designation itself is the vehicle that we're going to be using to be able to allow for the funding to be entered into 10-town for the roads. There shouldn't be, and from this is previous experience from what the grants that we did before in the CDBG grant, the Sun and Blight shouldn't affect your insurance, shouldn't affect that, but the designation does stay for 5 years. So upon another grant cycle for CDBG for additional funds, since that area is designated, we can go back and say, do we want to assign housing funds for this, the funds specifically for housing in that area, and then the council will go through the approval, we'll go through the entire process of publishing it, and so we're allowed to be able to use the funds we get from CDBG. Until then, the funds that we have from CDBG are currently limited. They are a little bit higher than we thought, they're about $214,000, and so that funding will be able to go into the street repair, because that is what's previously. But going forward again, in about 2.5 years, if you feel that you would like some additional funds inside that particular area designated for housing, that's one of the options that you can, what's your opinion on that?
Councilmember Klein.
I just want to reassure Mr. Chambers that a bulldozer will not come in and mow that area down. We're putting quite a bit of money into that area. It's been a long time coming, well over 20 years actually, and this goes way back to when Ruben Garcia was on the council and just trying to get the roads graded. And so it's been a very, very long process, but I think we're finally starting to see some real progress. And with the big project that we have going on there now, this is only going to help enhance and help the residents mm-hmm. there. And believe me, we would never come in and do that because we're pretty fond of Tin Town.
All right. So it sounds like mostly road improvements is what is approved mm-hmm. so far.
And in addition to that, besides, I just want to point out the advertising, we did have to, as part of the requirements, send individual letters to every homeowner in that area.
Just a point of clarification on the financing of it. Correct me if I'm mistaken. CDBG grants in the past were $350,000 every 2 years. Now they've been reduced to $214,000 every 3 years.
They were actually below $200,000 this year.
Yeah. I will add that I have been dealing with Senator McCain's office, Shea Salcedo in particular, about restoring those funds as to what they were in former years. And so I've been working with her to a certain degree and putting a little pressure on to a certain degree to see if we can get those restored. And I hope we do, because it's about our community's well-being. So it's important. Any other comments from the council? I'm going to close this public hearing. Ms. Carbajal, thank you. Item number 6, discussion of possible approval of resolution R-15-02, designating slum or blight areas in a portion of the Tin Town area, finding that redevelopment of these areas is necessary and in the public interest, and adopting a redevelopment plan for those areas. Once again, the city manager, Mr. Johnson.
Sally Mayor, what you have is a resolution kind of affirming the action that we just discussed. At this point, just moving for approval of the resolution.
Any comments or questions? Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve resolution R-15-02, designating slum or blight areas in the portion of Tin Town, finding that redevelopment of these areas is necessary and in the public interest, and adopting the redevelopment plan for these areas.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further comments, questions? No? Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hanson?
Aye.
Councilmember Doughty?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 7, discussion of possible approval of resolution R-15-03, reaffirming Bisbee's fair housing policy and acknowledging the city's commitment to the principles of fair housing. Once again, the city manager, Mr. Johnson.
Certainly, Mayor. As stated, it's been requested that we reaffirm our commitment to this particular policy and also the prohibition of discrimination in the sale, rental, leasing, and financing of housing and land to be used for construction or in the provision of brokerage services on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, etc. Any other questions?
Any questions or comments? No. Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve resolution R-15-03, reaffirming Bisbee's fair housing policy and acknowledging the city's commitment to the principles of fair housing.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any final comments or suggestions? No. Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hanson?
Aye.
Councilmember Doughty?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 8, discussion of possible approval of SIGO Region Transit Coordination Memorandum of Understanding between 5310 and 5311 grantees. Once again, the city manager, Mr. Johnson.
Certainly, Mayor. What you have before is an MOU prepared by SIGO requesting the city's commitment in coordinated efforts as it relates to our bus system in the event that, you know, we're down, whatever the case may be, a vehicle is down and either one of our agencies, our commitment to providing a sort of redundancy and duplication of services.
Any questions or comments from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move that we approve the SIGO Region Transit Coordination Memorandum of Understanding between 5310 and 5311 grantees.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 9, discussion of possible approval of resolution R-15-04, supporting the Bisbee Bus Transit Program and the application of funds to operate the Bisbee Transit Bus System. Once again, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor. What you have before you is a resolution as part of our grant application process, a resolution, a commitment on the city's support for this particular grant program. Do you have any questions to answer?
Any questions or comments from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move to approve resolution R-15-04 in support of the Bisbee Bus Transit Program and its continued administration and operation through various grant applications to the Arizona Department of Transportation, accepting grant funding and providing match if awarded, and authorizing the mayor to sign all applications and grant contracts.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further comments? Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hanson?
Aye.
Councilmember Doughty?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 10, discussion of possible approval of resolution R-15-05, supporting the City of Bisbee's formal adoption of the City of Bisbee's Transportation Amended Title 6 Plan. Once again, Mr. Johnson.
Certainly. And lastly, just a laughing, Ms. Shirley. A resolution was committing our support as part of the FTA grant process. So as a subrecipient, this is, quite frankly, a formality, as the rest have been.
Any questions from the council? Do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move to approve resolution R-15-05 in support of the City of Bisbee's formal adoption of the City of Bisbee's Transit Amended Title 6 Plan.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other comments? No. Ms. Williams, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hanson?
Aye.
Councilmember Doughty?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 11, discussion of possible approval of mutual release and settlement agreement between Glenvest LLC and the City of Bisbee regarding a complex and ongoing tax lien and quiet title action. Ms. Carl.
Yes, thank you. This action predates me. It's been going on for a number of years. It's very complex. There's no precedent in case law. Essentially, there was a drug foreclosure at a property that is located on Mill Avenue, 201 Mill Avenue, and the property was split in half with only, well, because it was split in half, there was some confusion at the county level about what to tax. And so the county levied a tax across the whole property, and that was problematic. And it's been problematic for a number of years. The county just settled this by just deeding the property over to Glenvest, and we had a sewer lien on the property, a couple of them. And again, this has been going on for a long time. I'm hoping that this gets resolved soon, because if the county takes over for legal services, because the county was kind of involved in what happened here, the council might be forced into getting outside legal help in order to resolve this ultimately if you don't resolve it soon. So there you have it.
Thank you. Any questions from the council?
Yeah.
Councilmember Connors.
Thank you, Mayor. How did the city of Bisbee come to acquire this piece of property through like a RICO? Or, go ahead.
No, this person, Glenvest, or his LLC, I can't remember
right
now. I haven't looked at it in a while, but he purchased a certificate of purchase for the tax lien. The city didn't get involved in that. The city just had a lien against the property for its own outstanding sewer bill. Okay, and so when the property got deeded over by the county, or actually in this case by the county attorney's office, because the state had in an action let the county attorney's office take on that role, when that happened, that was our interest in the property being deeded, you know, at least the portion of that property that amounted to our tax lien got deeded over to him. So again, there's no precedent, there's no legal precedent for what happened here. John McKinnon tried to resolve it. Maybe another attorney before him tried to resolve it. When it came to me, it was already a protracted problem, and there really is no resolution except to walk away in a sense, unless you want to spend money on more legal bills. Now, we can certainly do that if you want to do that.
Yeah, continue?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Councilmember Connors,
yeah,
again.
I'd love to spend more money on legal. Isn't just simply an unpaid sewer bill, no matter who owns the house, an unpaid sewer bill?
You think so?
No. Well, I'm, you know.
No.
Isn't an unpaid sewer bill an unpaid sewer bill?
Right. The problem is the lien, the certificate of purchase was on the other tax liens that were going on with that property too. Okay. So you know, they were paying off of, they were paying on, they purchased the certificate of purchase, and then after a certain amount of time, they have the ability to foreclose on the property, which is what this action was.
Who's they?
The person who purchases the certificate of purchase,
okay,
on the tax lien. So after that amount of time is triggered, they have that opportunity to go forward with the foreclosure action. the attorney in that action has the opportunity to ask for attorney's fees from the defendants. And certainly, you know, I don't feel that we need to or should pay those attorney's fees. But if we continue with this, you know, asserting our position, and it does go to a court hearing or series of hearings and a trial, we, you know, we'll be spending on that more than anything else. So this settlement just gives us an opportunity. The other issue here is that this property is kind of an eyesore, and so by settling it, this owner of the certificate of purchase has said that they are fully intending to fix up the property and make it.
They pay a $2,000 sewer hookup fee.
Well, we don't have that much invested, fortunately, in our with our liens. But you know, there is quite a bit of work that's needed at that property.
Okay. Thanks, Ann. Thank you, Mayor.
Councilmember Klein, go ahead.
I don't remember Mr. McKinnon ever talking about this, so I don't know that it's really come before us. But does Ms. Bono have a history on it that she could fill us in on? Or?
This first came to my attention last year with Mr. McKinnon, and the way I knew of it is that it was a joint ownership, two people on the property. One was, I guess we went to the house and there was an arrest and we confiscated that part of the ownership. So we had the property in lien and the bills were still going out, and the lady that had been incarcerated had been released, and she contacted me because she was getting these bills and there was a lien on the property. So she brought it to my attention. I brought it to Mr. McKinnon's attention. And it was a very complicated thing. That's kind of like where we left it at, because we weren't collecting at all on this property. And it's a dilapidated, I believe, property. So what happened was what Ms. Carl was saying is that we have a lien on the property. The only thing that supersedes a utility lien, to my knowledge, is if it's sold for property taxes. So what happened is the certificate of purchase of what Ms. Carl was talking about, it was sold for that. So at that point, our lien is null and void. Hmm. And I think that's when it kind of all came to a head that they had quit claiming the deed to this investment company. So technically, the part ownership, I don't know that there's any way to fix it. And I don't know that we would have ever recovered the lien on the property. So I also think that this is the best solution. But you know, it's a big headache when both people own it and the drug arrest, because we don't get to take the whole house. We don't get to take one interest in it.
Just a quick comment. I want to thank Ms. Carl for potentially getting this resolved tonight, hopefully. It is a very difficult, complex issue. And you mentioned that it's like a precedent of this type of situation. So it appears to me that what we're going to do is just wash our hands of this instead of getting in deeper and costing us a lot of money, possibly. Just get it out of the way. So that's my thoughts. Would you concur with that, Ms. Bono? Mayor, Councilmember Dunn.
Again, I'm now finally understanding the situation of this house, and it certainly is very complex. I've certainly heard a number of different stories over the years in terms of what was the status of this property. The bottom line is, it is an eyesore, it's a hazard, it's a serious blight to this community. It's on a back street, so most people don't see it, but it is something that needs to be taken care of, and if this will move us forward and getting that taken care of, then we need to move forward.
Thank you. Any other comments from the council? Do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move that we approve mutual release and settlement agreement between Glenn Vest LLC and the City of Bisbee.
I second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other comments? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 12, discussion of possible approval designating as surplus property the two metal frame cat cages in the animal shelter. City Manager, Mr. Johnson, you explain that one.
Thank you, Mayor. As stated, we have, by way of the Arizona Community Foundation, and again, I want to take a minute to thank Sharon for preparing the grant application and award. We have the opportunity to purchase two new cat cages if you get an opportunity. You actually have pictures in your packet, but to take a look and see what's there, the volunteers are very happy with what we have. Now, the cages that we're hoping to have disposed of tonight will give us an opportunity to property to sell them or donate them to another shelter in need or something along those lines. So we're just looking for council approval to properly dispose of that. Of those cages.
Any questions from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move to approve the designation of the two metal frame cat cages at the animal shelter as surplus property.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other thoughts? No other thoughts? All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 13. Discussion and possible approval of the State of Arizona's Department of Housing application for reservation of low-income housing tax credits regarding the Arizona Triangle Apartments.
Once again, the City Manager, Mr. Johnson. Certainly. You already have a letter in your packet that was received by me here last month, wanting the city's support in a transaction, the Arizona Triangle Apartments. As I understand it, it was a development company based out of, it's actually called a Crispin Development Enterprises. They're based up in Oregon. So they're looking to acquire the property, but as part of this process, there's a low-income housing tax credit program. So they're seeking this designation and support of these tax credits. Now, in part, we certainly support low to moderate housing in the community, but one of the things that was pointed out is the fact that there is a lien on the property and those owners owe a substantial amount of money, just upwards of $50,000. And so, through this transaction, once it sells, we'll have the opportunity to recover those funds. And so that's a mechanism that we have to try to make us whole in that particular area. So, and that's where we're looking tonight, this council support.
Thank you. On this item, if Ms. Buono would come back up, and this is probably more for public consumption, some details on this particular issue. Is it okay to ask how much is owed to the City of Bisbee on this?
We have a lien on this property for about $53,000. The current owners are making very small monthly payments, maybe a third of what is charged, the loan interest and fees. Currently, it's my understanding that they already have low-income residents in this home. So Mr. Ward was contacted by this organization that's in their practice about getting information on doing rehab and working on this. And in order for them to do that, they need these federal credits to be designated. What I'm excited about is that when the property transfers, we're going to get that. And I think that the next owners will stay current. There's, I believe, 23 units in this apartment complex. And if not, we have a information contract that we can use when they're not paying the shelters. This is a typical example of not shutting them. Why would, if we turned off this apartment complex and sewer, then there would be 23 residents that out. So this all falls into it. I fully support it because I'd like to get out of the lien business one day and have this money flowing.
Mm-hmm. Just for
no guarantee that's going to happen, but this is really is what's going to, if the community supports it, put it forward.
just for clarification and public consumption, when a property is sold, the liens are paid off first. Is that correct?
As long as it goes to a title company and it's not a quick claim deed, when you quick claim a deed from one person to another, you take the debt with it.
Right.
So it doesn't escape it, but when it does a proper transfer through refinancing or selling, then the liens have to be satisfied before that property is transferred, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just one final comment. It's not, don't have to comment on this. How do you get behind $50,000?
Well, we have 23 units, so we charge them with 23 sewer bills.
Any other questions or comments from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move to approve the application for low-income housing tax credits as submitted by the Arizona Triangle Apartments, LLC.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other comments? No other comments. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 14, discussion of possible approval to enter into an intergovernmental agreement between Cochise County and the City of Bisbee for legal services. And once again, Mr. Johnson, the city manager.
Thank you, Mayor. As a follow-up to our workshop a couple of weeks ago, what you have before you is an agreement with that will allow us to enter into an IGA or intergovernmental agreement with Cochise County for legal services for the sole purpose of locking in somewhat of a flat rate contract. County Attorney Britt Hanson is here if you have any additional questions, but again, it's a follow-up to our work session we had a couple of weeks ago.
We have a few people signed up on this particular agenda item, but I think that maybe we will go to Mr. Hanson first.
Thank you, Mayor and Council, Mr. Johnson, Ms. Carl. We had a work session on this a few weeks ago. I gave a presentation at that time. We had a back and forth at that time. Would you like for me to go through the presentation again for the public, or is it
really? What's the thoughts on the council?
Pardon?
Could you be brief in that area, because we already had an extensive work session on this, just so the council kind of understands and some of the concerns perhaps the council might have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. In very brief detail, this is a flat rate contract. The City of Bisbee would pay Cochise County $5,000 a month or $60,000 a year. To provide legal services, basically doing city attorney legal services. That will pay, from my end, that will help pay for a salary. It will help pay for benefits for an employee. That employee wouldn't be the person that would represent the city, because it would be myself as lead attorney, Elder Ordunio as the second attorney. I also mentioned Lori Owen was here at the work session, represents the sheriff, very familiar with law enforcement. She was a law enforcement officer for 13 years. So anyway, we would provide those services. You'd be hiring a team of attorneys, paralegal, and legal secretaries for $60,000 a year.
Thank you. Just one quick comment. I was in at Tombstone last week at a mayor manager's luncheon, and I mentioned that with the budgets of various municipal and county governments, that it appeared to me that a trend, not only here but across the country, will be consolidation of different governmental entities, and I think that is the wave of the future, and I think people are kind of understanding that. It is a little, it's different, and the older one gets, maybe one is a little more reluctant to change, but I think this is probably necessary. Any other comments from the council? And there'll be another opportunity. We have a couple of people signed up, and I need to call on them.
And if I can mention one more thing at the work session, I had mentioned that we were presenting this to the Board of Supervisors on April 7th for approval. They did approve it. I do have the agreement signed by Supervisor Pat Ball and Harold Peters.
Okay. Eric Farner, would you want to come up?
Councilor Farner, 609 Bisbee Road. I have a question to address it to the chair. The chair would address it to the people that have the answer on it.
We can do it that way.
Oh, yeah, I'm inclined very much I like this idea, but having been a survivor of the Maricopa County Wars, Belcayo, and Andrew Johnson, the first thing that popped in my mind on this was, what mechanism is in place the city and the county, in terms of like who their client is, the county and the city, and specifically how they have identified conflicts and how those are resolved. And it may be that the city might not be aware of a conflict, but the county attorney would. How would we make sure that the county attorney knows that, yeah, we have to, how do you enforce that?
Yeah. As long as I've been sitting in this seat, and I was here before some time ago, there never was a conflict. However, maybe Mr. Hansen or Ms. Carl would have some comments on that, perhaps?
Yeah, that's an important question. It's the first thing that came into my mind when Mr. Johnson and I spoke about this a few weeks ago. But honestly, as we mentioned in the work session, we have had very, very few interactions with this, between the county and the city, maybe too few. But the couple things that we do have going that potentially could be a conflict are the court consolidation, but that's the only thing that I can think of. Every once in a while, the highway, public works, IGA, but again, that's not really a negotiated contract. We'll have to be mindful of it. I think in terms of identifying it, probably working most closely with the city manager and the mayor, and I think there's smart people who see when there's a conflict, and I'm a professional, and I know when there's a conflict as well. I will add this, though. We represent the board supervisors, the treasurer, the sheriff, the county school superintendent, his successor, and there are potentially a myriad of conflicts, and we make sure it doesn't happen. So we've got a lot of experience trying to keep away from it.
The only concern, or I had two concerns, but the concern that I was interested in was a two-year contract. But let me say this, that I have a great deal of trust and confidence in Mr. Hansen, and if there was a potential problem that would arise, I think that we could verbally sit down and work that out. I have a great deal of confidence in that. Let me call the other person on this item, Mr. Jeff Harris.
Contract with the county for legal services. What's not mentioned here, or what should be mentioned, is the fact that only the city of Bisbee is seeking a new attorney. Douglas has a part-time attorney, Quan Flores. And it would certainly appear that for Douglas to get into this negotiation, it would insist that Quan Flores be the one who's hired. It seems awfully likely to me that what will end up happening is Quan Flores will be the attorney hired, and he will be half-time for Bisbee and half-time for Douglas. There seems to be far too much in the way of shenanigans going on here. I am very much opposed to this contract. I strongly urge you to reject.
Thank you. Let me make a comment. Come on up, Mr. Hansen. There's a reason, and I have concerns about a two-year contract, but there's a reason for that, because the county is going to go through some expense on that. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
The thing is, for the two-year contract, we are going to hire someone in, and you can't hire someone in and say you can be terminated tomorrow. We're a good employer. We try to be a good employer, and I think the city probably does the same thing. So I understand your point. Yes, you do give up a little control anytime you have an agreement other than an at-will agreement. And I should say that I did mention at the work session that we were in discussions with the city of Douglas about doing the same thing that we were talking to Mr. Justin and Mr. Johnson and the council about. And I had a discussion with the mayor yesterday, and that's not going to happen. So we're going back to plan A. We'll be hired in a paralegal. There's never been a discussion with Mr. Forrest.
So let me ask another question. So we will have an attorney from the county sitting here at the council sessions. In case I do something illegal, they can tell me, right? Is that true?
Okay.
They'll be here. And so anytime we have a question, we can make that phone call to the county, and they can help advise us.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions from the council?
I have a question.
Council Member Sullivan.
Mr. Hansen, how much time will you be available to spend here in the office at the city?
In terms of the number of office hours, I'm going to try and do half a day. I'm going to try and have Ella half a day. That doesn't mean that's kind of office hours time, and I'm going to have to find a time that will work for everyone. But I kind of foresee this, the availability, the same way I'm available at the county. I have over at the Board of Supervisors office or that Melody Lake complex, you know, probably 2 or 3 hours every day. But it's to attend meetings and get together with people. So it's kind of an on-call kind of thing. I do the same thing with the sheriff and folks in the old high school, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of how I foresee this.
So you're saying you would be here a half a day, and then Elda would be here a half a day, and
well,
you'd be on call?
That's kind of what Elda and I have discussed in between us, but we'll be here a lot more than that. I'm not saying that's all the time we'll be here, because people will have meetings, and we will need to be here. Again. So, and kind of depends on how heavy that schedule is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I understand that this is different, at least going back a couple years when Bisbee had a full-time attorney. This is a big shift from that, where somebody had their office and they were there all day long. You could just pop in. I think this is kind of a more efficient way to do things, but I know it is a big difference and a big change in the city.
So didn't you say at the work session that Douglas was also thinking of possibly contracting with the county, and if that happened, it was going to be a good thing, because then between Bisbee and Douglas, you'd have enough money to pay the paralegal.
No, we'd have enough money to pay actually a fourth attorney in the office.
Ah, okay.
And that would have been the ideal solution, but that's not going to happen. It's going to go back to my name. We have, and the $60,000 is enough for us to hire a paralegal and pay benefits and pay all the office.
So then what is the benefit to you and your firm if you're really just hiring on one other person? You're not gaining anything financially, really. You're just gaining another person.
There's a couple of thousand dollars. The $60,000 is a little bit more than it'll cost to supply a paralegal, but it's not going to go in anybody's pocket. I'm going to set up a fund line, so it keeps going back in that fund line. So if God
willing we someday get a raise, I'll have money to give that person a raise. Or, you know, whatever might come up. So I'll just keep building on that fund line. But no, this is not a profit-making opportunity. That's not what we do.
So you just want to do it for the goodness of your heart, or?
That might be a little bit much. But we see our mission as good government, and we have an opportunity to do that on a fairly cost-efficient basis for the city of Bisbee. I live here, I love this little town, and if we can contribute, yeah, I'd like to contribute. I know this sounds funny to maybe a lot of people in the audience, maybe not so much the council, these folks sitting over here, but the reason we're doing this is because we like to do public service, and so there you go.
Nice.
Any other council member comments?
Way to go.
Oh.
Yeah, I just...
Council Member Dunn.
Yes, yeah. I also have a high level of confidence in Britt Hansen and the county attorney's office, certainly as indicated in the work session. I mean, most of our contact with council is by email. I mean, we have a question. I mean, that's the most efficient way. We don't come into office and make office appointments. We email, and there's immediate response to that. I certainly was also involved when we last solicited bids from attorney's offices, and so went through, saw what it would cost us to go with some other alternative in terms of contracting with a private law firm to provide a service. And we are, as I've said earlier this evening, we're moving into a very tight budget session here, budget this year. This is just very positive in terms of budget-wise. It's also very positive in terms of the level of service we're getting. And I anticipate, again, it's just an email away in terms of responding to my needs. So I certainly favor this.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions from the council?
I have a comment.
Council Member
Mayor.
Sullivan.
You know, I do feel that Mr. Harris made a really valid point about not going into a legal agreement based on trust alone. Of course, we trust Mr. Hansen, and he's got a great reputation, and he works with all the other county, everything that he's mentioned. But isn't it possible to amend the contract a little bit to be a little more specific and clear as to what is going to qualify as a conflict of interest, or what happens in that case? Or I'm also concerned about the fact that if they are too busy on another case, then we are going to have to hire in extra attorneys and take that full cost.
Well, you're looking down this way, but I think maybe we should look over at Mr. Hansen.
Well, I'm also talking to you. I usually try and address the council. But, I think that it would be good to work on the agreement a little bit more, personally. I'm not real satisfied with it.
Any other questions or comments from the council? No other questions or comments. Do we have a motion?
Yes, I move approval to enter into an intergovernmental agreement between Cochise County and the City of Bisbee for legal services.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. On this particular item, Ms. Williams, I need a roll call vote.
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hansen?
Aye.
Councilmember Dowdy?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early?
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Item number 15, discussion of possible approval to enter into an agreement with the Urban Land Institute Technical Assistance Panel. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor. Several months ago, November, December, we brought before you a proposal that will allow us to participate in the Urban Land Institute's Technical Assistance Panel, which will bring folks from the development and real estate community to our community to really provide us with high-level oversight input and opportunities for discussion as it relates to, you know, development opportunities, planning opportunities, things we need to look at as a community that could probably be our focus. The cost associated with the this particular program is being underwritten by the Union Pacific Foundation. I can give the full name. And so, but the goal is to have the ULI TAP team come down June the 9th. And again, it's an all-day, really brainstorming session. The city, if I'm not mistaken, the Cochise County is participating in the same program that same weekend, but here recently, Casa Grande has participated, AZ Globe, Globe Miami has participated recently. And so, again, this is the actual contract with ULI to participate in that particular program at no cost to us.
Any questions or comments from the council? I just have a couple. It seems like it's stressed to the downtown area. Is that downtown? No, what's this right here?
Not
Main Street.
I'm sorry.
It's wide open. And so when we identified in the application packet, hey, here's some areas we can look at, whether it's the airport, San Jose, it could be housing. Wherever the case may be, once the panelists are all put together, we'll come together in conjunction with the city to say, hey, look, what's our primary focus here? And so, and what are the I won't say low-hanging fruit, but what are the realistic opportunities that we can capitalize on, or what opportunities we want to focus on? And so it's not necessarily the downtown corridor. It could be, you know, the issue of housing. It could be, you know, the relationship with the school district. Whatever the case, it's somewhat of a nebulous area of focus, but we really won't have it defined until all the panelists are put together and we have our meeting with the folks up in Phoenix to really come together and talk about the particular program. A guidebook was put together that talks about some of the demographics of the community, what are some of the major issues that's sent up to ULI, and they use that somewhat of as a template, so to speak, to really start formulating ideas and points of discussion. Many of the people that are on the panel have visited Bisbee, they're familiar with some of the issues to some degree, so that's what you got. But it's not just solely dedicated to Old Bisbee. It, quite frankly, can be wide open to a number of focus areas.
Okay. I was looking around a little bit in the area of the Union Pacific Building America Foundation, and it appears to me that they get out a lot of grants. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that Benson got two or three, Nogales got three, and I'm thinking maybe we should be friendly with this foundation, not necessarily the Urban Land Institute, which I presume are being paid from the Union Pacific Building America Foundation. Would that make sense?
Yes, sir.
My other question is, I'm not opposed to this, I'm just curious about things. So they're going to be here one day,
mm-hmm.
Right? So we are supposed to create a briefing book. Who would create the briefing book? Who would set that
it's
up?
Already completed. Mm-hmm. I chimed in. Karina worked very diligently and it's pretty much a demographic profile. You're pulling information from your general plan. You're pulling information from various planning documents to put that together. So it's already done.
Oh, okay. Well, that negates that question. The other thing that I'm wondering is, so a group of people, maybe the number was here. How many would be coming down the Urban Land Institute? Five?
Upwards of nine, if I'm not mistaken. It may be a little bit less. The number that's sticking in my head right now is nine.
Would members of the council or organizations in the city hang out with them that day?
Absolutely. It's wide open, and it was brought to my attention that potentially the folks from the national office are looking to come down and actually film the tap as and really to feature and showcase Bisbee as we go through this process. And ULI, they're really placing a lot of emphasis state to state on the technical assistance panels. And so Arizona has really taken the lead in this particular program, and so I'm very excited to have the opportunity to participate, especially at no cost to us.
Another area I was just wondering about, the Urban Land Institute, obviously the city of Bisbee could only use that in a non-commercial way, but in that particular paragraph here, it does not say that the Urban Land Institute, they could sell that, right? If they want to, that's kind of what I read here. We're the sponsor. The Institute may publish and disseminate such report or any part thereof in conjunction with its research and educational programs.
All the reports are posted on their website. So if you go to ULI Arizona and go to AZTAP, you can actually look at the reports.
Okay. I'm not opposed to this. I'm just some sure. areas no, I no get problem. Curious as to how this bureaucracy essentially functions and all these groups kind of all entangled together. But I would highly recommend to look into the Union Pacific Building America Foundation, since areas, and they give out lots of money all over the country, massive amounts, I couldn't believe it. So we might be able to come up with something that they would think would be
beneficial to us and make them look good too.
So, relationship building is good.
Councilmember Klein.
Well, that was the only question I had, is why was Union Pacific Building American Foundation willing to be the underwriter? I mean, you know, why Bisbee? Why this?
Quite frankly, I don't have an answer why. I mean, that's the arrangement, the setup, and the relationship that ULI has with Union Pacific. So why did they come together on this? Quite frankly, I'm not sure. They're footing the bill, so I didn't ask the question, so maybe I should have.
Mayor?
Oh, Councilmember Glenn.
The liaison to the iBisbee Commission, yeah. Committee, who has initiated this, and in response to your question is that Union Pacific Foundation came forward and acknowledged that this type of service often is difficult for small communities to carry out, and so they're supporting small communities. It's not just Bisbee. So this is a program in this state and others, I believe. Also, in clarification in terms of what will guide this group of experts, the iBisbee committee has developed a list of questions in terms of specific topics they would like this panel to zero in on. And looking at our housing mix is one of those. And so they will come down with these questions as well as this book in terms of our resources. But there will be a focus. They're just not going to come down and poke around and share their insights with us. They will be asked specifically to respond to the several issues that have been identified by the iBisbee committee for their attention.
Councilmember Dunn, could you identify some of those iBisbee questions?
One of the prime focus is housing. I mean, I think we've talked about in the past that we have a number of housing units on the market right now that aren't selling. At the same time, we have a number of people who are living and working in this community who are going elsewhere to live, which would indicate, on one hand, not everybody wants to buy a fixer-upper. That's not their desire in terms of housing, and is, you know, that's one of the questions. Do we have a proper housing mix, and how do we broaden that mix to get more Border Patrol agents, more Cochise College and faculty members to live in this community rather than commuting elsewhere to live, as is somewhat occurring now. There's also a special interest, has been a continuing discussion in terms of the use of the airport. What are some options there in terms of the utilization of that property, particularly its proximity to Mexico? Certainly your reference is interesting, the downtown infill was something that's I wasn't aware of myself. It's interesting how that came up in the application, but those are two of the prime issues that that will be looked at.
Councilmember Dowdy.
So the iBisbee committee contacted these people to come and look at the community.
Correct, and they're the ones that, again, I think was initiated. This is something that Mr. Justin was aware of and brought to our attention, and the committee enthusiastically responded. The more we pursued this, the more excited we were in terms of, again, the iBisbee has been going through this process of educating ourselves in terms of what our development options move from just wishful thinking to, you know, what really do we have and what really is possible. It's going to be somewhat like the Charette's, but not like, you know, that was a planning effort, but this is much more. It's going to be development people. It's going to be key investors, developers in the region. And so, as you say, it's going to be tremendous allies here as we move forward in whatever direction. So,
Councilmember Klein.
That was going to be my question as well. Are you, or will ULI be looking at the Charette information?
That's part of the package that's been provided to them, is the two results of the two Charettes, okay. Yes.
Thank you.
One comment. They're only going to be down here for one day, and it doesn't seem like very long. But what's important is certainly they're going to be looking at the physical infrastructure, but I think it's very important to not only look at and understand the social infrastructure, the people that live here, but actually get and talk to them. And I'm talking about across the complete economic and social demographics of the community. It's real important for them to get a feel of who lives here and what their thoughts are. And in this community, there are lots of thoughts, and they all seem to be different, which is not a bad thing.
So I think it's important that they understand and get out among the people, however they could do that. I'm not exactly sure how that would be implemented, but just get out. It take a couple of hours at least, and just talk to people at random. I think that's like really important. I don't have any other comments. Any other Councilmember Sullivan?
I guess for Mr. Johnson, in this agreement, City of Bisbee is the sponsor, and so does that mean we are going to be paying a possible upwards of $5,000? No, that's covered by the Union Pacific
Foundation. Yes.
Okay, all right. But it, do we pay it and then it gets reimbursed?
No.
No? Okay, that was my only question. Thank you.
Any other? Councilmember Connors.
Well, we might have to buy some coffee and donuts and things like that, right?
Yes, sir. I think that would
be a proper host.
Be a good host, yes.
So there will be some cost.
Yes, sir.
And Mr.
Mayor
Johnson.
If I may, I don't want to take credit, but I know this is something that Mr. Stern has worked on even just prior to my arrival, so I want to give credit where credit is certainly due.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Mayor, I move approval to enter into agreement with the Urban Land Institute for technical assistance panel.
Second it.
We have a motion and a second. Any further questions or thoughts? Council member?
I think this is such a great idea when I heard about it. It's such an opportunity for Bisbee to really plan out and to really see exactly what the needs are of the community. So I really want to thank the iBisbee committee for getting so involved with it.
Any other comments? All those in favor?
Aye.
We already have a motion and a second. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Item number 16, discussion of possible approval to remove the caveat on the Turquoise Valley Golf Course stating that the property shall be used solely and exclusively as a golf course, somewhat of a sort of a divided issue here in town to a certain degree. I can't tell how it's divided, but we had a work session on this about 3 weeks ago or so. Interesting and a lively work session. So I think what we are going to do is we have a few people signed up. I think the issue is pretty clear. Mr. Pete Campbell, are you here? Yeah.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Pete Campbell, Bisbee resident, general manager of Turquoise Valley. And it should be no surprise that I would like to advocate a vote to remove the golf course-only caveat or restriction that's been placed upon the front nine property of the golf course. The history of the situation is that the land was donated in the 1930s by a local family. The intent of the restriction was to keep the property in use as a golf course and solely as such, and therefore a reversion clause, I'm not certain of the legal vernacular, but a clause was put in place that if ever the original front nine property of the golf course is ever used as anything other than a golf course or anything other than solely a golf course, the property would revert to the Newell family. So it's only understandable that when Peter and Leslie Lawson purchased the golf course from the city of Bisbee, a procedure that was approved in 1999 and wasn't completed until 2001, it's entirely understandable that the caveat was in turn placed upon the Lawsons, with the interest being preserving a unique property, a unique resource that's been associated with Bisbee and that's been a benefit to Bisbee for a number of years. However, times have changed. The 1930s were a heyday for our communities, and it made sense to protect the lands for golfing purposes back then to make sure that it wouldn't get used for ultimate, perhaps specious purposes. But where or when we are today is the current owners are reaching their intended retirement age and they'd like to move on. After millions of dollars invested in the golf course and the community over nearly 20 years of ownership, they've got the golf course ready for sale. They understand it's difficult to sell any golf course, even under the best of circumstances, but this one restriction has proved prohibitive over the years, and they're being removed. I understand that the city, perhaps some of its residents, might question the merits of this request. However, it's my opinion that enforcing the restriction would likely ultimately create the very scenario that it's intended to avoid. Enforcing the restriction would probably ultimately lose the golf course for Bisbee. If one looks at potential other uses of that property, it is truly best set to be a golf course. All of the interested parties with whom I've spoken many over the years are interested in it solely for, or primarily for it as a golf course. It's the golf course that attracts the investors down here. And granted, it has numerous other resources, the RV park, the awesome restaurant, the banquet facilities, a number of local children have grown up here into adults, and there have been many generations of families that have grown up through the golf course. All of those resources would be less formidable, if not worse, without the golf course. So the golf course is what's generating the interest. And in terms of other developments, Bisbee is certainly an attractive community. It's where we all call home. And, but looking at the facts, we're not exactly thriving, as perhaps the last point would illustrate. When I first moved here, there were about 6,300 people in town, and according to the 2013 census, I think they're estimating it at roughly 5,400 people in town. It's not those demographics that potential investors are interested in when they're looking at Turquoise Valley. It's the golf course. And golf courses are still considerable boons to all areas in which they're located. However, this clause is really prohibiting any interest from, ultimately prohibiting any interest from private backers or banking backers. And keep in mind that Peter and Leslie are Canadian citizens, and in addition to their own retirement objectives and goals and being tired after nearly 20 years of ownership, they also operate under restrictions of a visa. And they're finding the visa renewal process with the United States to be a chronically more odious process every time they do it. And they're not sure they have the energy to renew a visa. They're not sure they will be approved for a visa renewal. And so that deadline is hanging over their heads. If the clause is not lifted, Lawson's will probably feel forced into recovering their investment in the golf course by any means necessary, which would mean selling off everything that they own that's unencumbered, which would be the machinery. I mean, $250,000 of equipment just in maintaining the golf course, the inventory, the bar inventory, the liquor license, all of the other facilities, the actual building from floor to roof, walls in between, effectively everything that's not the front nine. And that would not leave Bisbee in a position of strength at all. It would ultimately leave the city with 10 golf holes, which it would be poorly, inadequately, or perhaps zero equipped to maintain. And therefore, with the reversion clause placed on the city, ultimately the city would lose a golf course anyway. Now, there are surviving Newell family members living in town, and most of you may have heard one or two of them speak quite eloquently at the March 10th meeting that they're in agreement to lift the covenant from Bisbee, provided Bisbee lifts the covenant from current ownership. And I'm only asking, Turquoise Valley is only asking, and I'm asking this not just as an employee at the golf course, but as a citizen of Bisbee, somebody who cared deeply for the community before I ever took a job in MAPO, and that is, let's look at the spirit of the covenant rather than the letter of the law. And lifting the clause would make the golf course a more attractive and viable property to any potential investors who would be looking to pick up the baton and take this piece of work that Peter and Leslie have turned into an amazing property and an amazing resource for town. And there are investors who want to take it where it's at and actually take it the next steps into the future. Not lifting the clause, keeping this restriction, restricts the current ownership's ability to sell Turquoise Valley in its current state, and that would reduce their options, and I believe it would be ultimately unfortunate and downright harmful to the community. So I think in this case we should look at the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law, because upholding the covenant might very well ensure the very situation it was set in place to prevent. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Sure. Councilmember Dunn?
Pete, we have a map that was presented by Mr. Lawson, and I'm still confused as to, in terms of the total Turquoise Valley golf course property, part of which we own and is under lease to you, part of which is owned...
1999.
Right. The rest is owned outright. And you're talking about that the city now owns the first 10 golf holes, but we don't own the country club. Is that correct?
The city does not even own the front nine. The city voted to sell even. Here's what happened. A group of private investors at the time, they were called the Disney Golf Association, and they were later coalesced under a gentleman by the name of Lauren Brewer. They purchased the business that is the golf course. They installed an irrigation system. They did all of the work, and they effectively owned the golf course business without owning the physical property that is the golf course, the 100 acres. They were leasing the 100 acres of the front nine on a $1 per year lease. After a few years of ownership, Peter Lawson petitioned the city of Bisbee to allow him to actually purchase the front nine, those 100 acres. And the city voted to do so. This it's resulted in roughly $500,000 in property taxes that the county had never benefited from in any of its previous incarnations as a golf course, and it's resulted in a number of other positive things for the community. But in selling the golf course to Peter, it placed four restrictions on the land. The first was that if the front nine is ever not a golf course or not solely operated as a golf course or used in solely golf-specific purposes, the land would revert to the city of Bisbee. The other caveats are using treated wastewater when made available, treating archaeological artifacts with all sanctity, and I'm spacing on the fourth, but I know...
Annexation.
Thank you. Agreeing to be annexed if the city of Bisbee does want to annex the property.
I'm still confused. And if the city chose to cancel your lease, what piece of property are we talking about that would return then, or it still is now owned by the city? I mean, I'm confused.
None of the property is owned by the city. The only restriction on the property is that if this transfers from Peter Lawson to any and all future owners of that property, and the restriction is that if ever that land is used for anything other than a golf course, the city of Bisbee would assume control, would assume ownership of the property. It's not currently an owner of the property. Now, the property in question is the original and historic 100 acres, which stretches from Newell Street north to Greenbush Draw. And on the east end of the property, it's just inside the old cemetery or the old burial ground. There's kind of a draw that crosses there. And on the west side of the property, it's it jumps at 90 degree angles. It's from just inside Towner Street, and then it goes over to Towner Street, and then a little bit beyond Towner Street.
Doesn't go to the Naco Highway then, or?
No, not quite to Naco Highway.
And it certainly does not include the lower 8 or 9.
Doesn't include anything that's north of Greenbush Draw. It does not include the RV park.
Correct.
It does not include the overflow lot, and it does not include the open property that's just east of the overflow lot.
Okay, well, that's what I wanted to clarify for all of us, right? Okay. So we're not talking about the whole property. We're talking because you do, quote, own outright those adjoining properties. And
Turquoise Valley.
Right.
Mayor? Councilmember Connors.
Thank you, Mayor. Pete, how much did Pete Lawson pay the city?
He paid the city $400,000.
$400,000 that we've already been paid for.
Correct.
For this piece of property.
Yes.
And the county's collecting tax on this now.
Correct.
So we've already been paid for $400,000 for this piece of property.
You are correct, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Quick question. I believe this came up in the work session. He has it for sale for $800,000 now?
I
think he said that, but I'm not sure. Did he say that?
I don't remember that. He would say that.
Okay. Why do I have that number in my head?
He might have. I believe $800,000 was offered to him, and he turned it down about 2 years ago, or about a year and a half ago.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mayor.
No, I'm done. Go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Hey, Pete, would you tell me that little anecdote, that quick one, about somebody else that
well,
he turned
sure,
down?
Actually, yeah. You know, in terms of anybody you might question Peter's motives, I mean, you're talking about a couple who invested, you know, not counting any of their other endeavors within Arizona, within Cochise County, just purely on Turquoise Valley alone, I would guess $5 million that he has put into it. You're talking about the initial purchase price, installing irrigation, purchasing the back nine, installing irrigation, renovating the clubhouse twice. He's put a lot into it, and he cares about the property. You know, he cares very much about the citizens of Bisbee, and he's actually, to his own, this is purely anything but self-serving in his case. It was purely a selfless action. He, I believe, twice has turned down offers from people, perhaps more than that, turned down offers from people whose motives he questions, whom he didn't think were acting in the best interests of the customers of Turquoise Valley, the citizens of Bisbee, the staff of Turquoise Valley. And that's true.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell, first off, I want to say I've heard a lot of people tell me that you've done a magnificent job out there. I think most of the community knows that, and we appreciate that. But I think what we're going to do, I have some questions, and since you're directly associated with it, and probably know more than other speakers, perhaps, I'd like to get the other speakers, then we'll have you come back up. Okay. Dave Carton.
Mayor, members of the council, City Manager Johnson. My name is Dave Carton. I live 100 yards outside the city limits. I spent considerable time at the golf course trying to play golf. And our Kiwanis Club has probably held, I think, since I've been at 25 events down there, including the top 10 for students, which is happening tomorrow. We had our 100th year celebration of Kiwanis International, the 91st year down there. I'm only saying this because Turquoise Valley has the only banquet room that can actually accommodate functions like that with the kitchen floor. When I first came to Bisbee, people said, Dave, you're going to go through a time tunnel. I said, okay. They said, when you go through it, you go back in time. And it was true to a point. The biggest impression I ever had when I came to Bisbee right away, I was walking up Main Street. I was head of the Chamber of Commerce. And two cars stopped going in the opposite direction and talked to each other in the middle of the road. And I just come out of Tucson where it took me three times as long to get to the airport as it used to when I moved there. But anyhow, people talk a lot in the community that we don't want to change the community. Well, we have to be blunt about it. You know, things have changed all around us. And our community has to adapt to that. We've also got a question of financial survival coming up here in the future. And we cannot deny that. We've lost population, which has been mentioned. We've lost children in the school system. We've lost jobs. We've lost businesses. So we have to be realistic about economics here. The economic impact hit Bisbee later than most communities because a high percentage of people here are employed by government or nonprofits like the hospital. And we've lost jobs, and we can't make up for it. We're having a hard time with that. Pete's mentioned that Pete Campbell spent $5 million, and Betty did, and everything that Pete talked about. Now, I have training, and I spent a lot of years as a landscape designer and contractor. Take a visual trip with me. Tonight, you vote no, and then you go out to the golf course, and you drive down Mill Street, and the first thing you see on the left is a for sale sign on one half of the RV park. That's real property owned by Peter and Leslie Lawson. You turn into the clubhouse, you go inside the banquet room, there's no chairs, there's no tables, you go into the dining room, everything is gone, the whole building is vacant. You go around back, there's no golf carts, there's no machinery of any kind because the Lawsons have had to sell it to try to recoup their money. You look at the first tee box, the grass is 10 inches high and it's brown, it hasn't been cut. The second green and the putting green, which you can see from the windows in the clubhouse, are brown, misspent. They will never come back without about a year's work on it. If the city has it, I know you don't have this idea, but if you pretend that you do, and you wanted to put the golf course back into use, you'd have to spend a minimum of $700,000 to $800,000 to buy equipment, get everything going again. And it's just an impossible job. Pete mentioned everything that's been going on with the Lawsons. It would actually, if you wanted to operate the golf course yourself, you'd have to cut the fire and ambulance department in half and probably cut the street department out completely. Can you imagine doing that just to run a golf course? The most important thing here tonight is that Mr. Law and Mrs. Lawson be able to transfer that property to somebody who's interested in keeping it as a golf course and possibly has the wherewithal and the future instinct to make it into a destination resort where you might have some housing on the property so people could stay overnight. It would help the restaurant. The sales taxes would come in again and would help the community. And that's the big advantage. You have a lot of RVers that come here every winter. We have one we'd like to talk to tonight, Mr. Durkin. They spend a lot of money in the city. If that's not a golf course, they ain't coming. And you're going to lose that revenue. You have to look at keeping the golf course as a positive revenue stream. I read in the paper that, I don't think it was at your work session, but I'm not sure, where somebody tried to say that the city should extort $120,000 from the potential buyer. You got to be kidding me. Who's going to pay $120,000 to take over an operation that's losing money? Where did that come from? I think, Pete, having covered everything, I think I'm just going to stand here as a member of the community, as a former member of the council who sold the property to Mr. Lawson, but couldn't finalize it, and I left the council beforehand. I had nothing to do with any of these four caveats that were placed on the sale. But myself and Bob Kassoon and four other council members, it was a 6-1 vote to sell the property. And we were happy to do it because it was a liability. This golf course can be a positive revenue stream to the community, and it's an asset to the community for tourism. And I was so disappointed when the first Bisbee Great Big Tourism brochure came out 3.5 years ago. It didn't mention the Turquoise Valley Golf Course. How come? People like to go out and they like to entertain themselves, get exercise, play golf, and do other things. So that kind of gave me an opinion. So I ask you to please consider this. Mr. Mayor, I think you called it a treasure.
Indeed it is. It's a historical treasure. Absolutely.
And it's also now a beautiful treasure and a viable treasure if somebody locally can buy the property and work it and keep it open. It's an absolute treasure what Mr. and Mrs. Lawson have done with the help of Pete Campbell and Bob Roof, the supervisor out there. It's really wonderful. And I urge you, all of you, to think positive about this. Think to the future, and please remove this caveat. It's to your own benefit, and it will help the taxpayers. And you have a fiduciary duty to the taxpayers of the city of Bisbee to make the best use of your assets, not to turn it into a liability. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Let's move on to Mr. Bill Durkin.
My name is Bill Durkin, and I come from Alberta. I'm a winter visitor down here. I've been here for 19 years. I live here 6 months every year. And in that time, I probably spent personally $200,000 in this community. Now, as winter visitors, we support the grocery stores, the service stations, automotive repairs, the hardware. We go in groups to every restaurant in the community, once a week at least, if not more. We support local churches. We go to the seniors' events in the community. We make donations to shelters. We also support the charity golf tournaments that support the youth of Bisbee. We always enter these tournaments. There's the junior golf program we support. Now, on top of the golf fees we pay, RV rental, people have built homes that want to stay on this golf course. People rent homes down here in the winter. We support the utility companies. We have internet, cable. I keep a permanent phone here, a permanent post office box. This is a second home, basically. In the 19 years I've been here, I would estimate that on an average, there were probably 40 people like myself, or our couples. And if this golf course is closed, which would happen if the KBS got moved, I would say it would remove $300,000 to $400,000 a year out of this community. Because if we don't have a golf course, we're not coming back. And golf course isn't viable without an RV park. And the city of Bisbee wouldn't own the RV park. So you wouldn't have control on that. And I want to make one correction. You wouldn't have 10 holes, you would have 10 and a half holes. Just to correct this. So it's my opinion that if this KBS not removed and the owner says, I'm going to want the gate to sell my assets, now I'm going to repeat what Bob said. You're going to have a golf course with no equipment, no rental equipment, no pro shop, no restaurant, no banquet hall. You're going to have an irrigation system that's going to have to be revamped, because once it's shut down, you don't know what's going to happen to it. And I would say $1 million might be in hand to get it up and running properly and stock it properly. And then you still only got 10 and a half holes. So who's going to come and play a nine-hole golf course? And right now, you've got the best package in Arizona, as far as I'm concerned, right here. And there's a lot of new people who are coming in, but they've all got the same concerns. What's going to happen? So I strongly urge you to move. We're already looking for other places. We're on the internet. We're finding places. We're going to move, but this doesn't happen. And I feel sorry for the city of Bisbee. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell, would you want to come back up? It's not my intent to interrogate you, and I'll try not to do that. I do have some questions. I'll try to put a smile on my face and make it easy, okay? I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't like doing that to people, but maybe I will. Mr. Lawson mentioned that he had a couple of buyers during the work session, and I'm sure the council remembers that. And he said that they wanted to keep it as a golf course. Well, that sounded good to me. I like that. But he said he wanted the caveats off. So I'm wondering, well, if they're going to keep it as a golf course, why is it important to have the caveat taken off?
That's a good question. It depends on the actual potential purchaser. And there's actually, believe it or not, I'm not lying, a third guy entered into the picture today completely. I came to this meeting not nearly as prepared as I would have preferred, because I had to devote a few hours of a chunk of my day to a pretty big guy, U of A, a Miami gentleman who's built 7 golf courses in Arizona and in California. He was looking pretty seriously at Turquoise Valley and is keenly interested in what happens here tonight. Whether or not he's the third serious investor, I'm not really certain, but the reason is, and believe it or not, on my meager wages, and I have the best job in Cochise County, barring, you know, anybody who else is here, and Justin, and, you know, anybody else, and I've got a fantastic job, but what makes Turquoise Valley so viable is the amazing people, a lot of them, who work at undermarket value, doing so much with so little, so much of the time, giving Bisbee a phenomenal phenomenally outstanding golf course of a quality that far belies the minimal green fees that we charge to play. I mean, and I talked to guys from the U of A, from U of A Romney School, from the Arizona Golf Association, who routinely say that while our course layout can't compare to the Jack Nicholson designed courses or, you know, the things up in Scottsdale, our grass conditions and the overall experience and product actually favor or compare favorably, if not better, than $200 to $250 golf course, you know, charging, or basically charging golf courses. Now, at one point, I was looking into purchasing a golf course. And, you know, I can run the golf course to a profit, but I can't take out the loan necessary to purchase the golf course and then take out a loan on the loan necessary to do whatever changes I would like to do to the golf course. It can be run to a profit, but it can't be run to a profit where you're having to pay off $25,000 a month every month for 30 years to, you know, pay off whatever loans it would take to purchase it. Banks are not going to loan you money if there are caveats on the property that they will be loaning for.
I wonder about that. What is your supporting evidence that is a true fact? I don't know much about real estate, but I'm wondering, why wouldn't they?
Because they, if everything goes wrong, they like to take it over.
That's the question my follow-up question. So you sell it to somebody, or Mr. Lawson sells it to somebody without the caveat on, right? And for whatever reason, they can't make the payments. Mm-hmm. It goes in default, the bank forecloses, the bank has it. Do you think they care, the bank, if they get possession of that, whether that is a historical treasure or not? I highly doubt it.
No.
They will sell it to anybody for any purpose to get to recoup as much money as they can.
Surely. However, that would be, in effect, no difference than what would happen if you don't remove the caveat. I mean, if you don't remove the caveat, Peter's going to sell anything and everything he owns, and Disney would be left with, and to do you one better, Mr. Durkin, 10 complete golf holes plus a set of tee boxes and a green. So that could be 10 and a half. But you look at that, the city would take it over. It wouldn't have the equipment to run it. When the city, and I've looked at the papers, I didn't bring any documentation today, but I've had access to the research. I'm sure you could probably find it too, that in the 1980s, the city had lost over $60,000 in just 1 year alone on the golf course, when it was a nine-hole golf course before it looked anything as it looks now. I mean, golf is not typically a profitable business. Municipalities keep golf courses operating and running because of all of the residual benefits that occur, such as detailed by Messrs. Carton and Durkin. However, the caveat doesn't go. The golf course is probably going to go anyway. Peter will sell off everything he needs in order to get his money back, to retire, you know, to be back in Canada by the time his visa expires so he can remain a, you know, within good legal standing with the United States. The city of Bisbee will be left with 100 acres that were shaped as a golf course, not the means to take care of them. And they'd also be among Turquoise Valley's many, many unique selling propositions. The city would be left without perhaps its most unique and travel-worthy proposition, which is the par six. You know, you've got the fifth longest golf hole in the United States, the 10th longest in the world. It's the only par six in the state of Arizona, and we've got people from Switzerland staying in our RV park right now who found out about Turquoise Valley and Bisbee because of the par six. You wouldn't have that.
Well, let me ask this question. What is the problem of just hanging loose for a little while till you come across a buyer that doesn't have a problem with the caveat being on? What do you think of that?
I don't think that's going to happen.
You don't think that's going to happen? Well, you had a third buyer today.
Mm-hmm.
A couple weeks ago, you only had two. So now you got another one.
Far, far more than that. But as long as I've been there, and I've been going through this since 2009 probably, and I've invested hundreds of hours of work in this, you know, entertaining people, talking to them, going through the numbers, and ultimately having deals falling apart because of the caveat.
Okay, well, this third buyer, is that important to him, or he hasn't
it
expressed
is.
That?
He's,
so you're in on the negotiations with that.
He's keenly interested in finding out what happens to him.
Okay.
That will significantly impact his interest in the property.
Okay, well, what I'm curious about is in 1998, Mr. Lawson bought that property with a caveat on. And the council at that time felt that was a guarantee, sort of like an insurance policy, that it would always remain a golf course. I'm sure that's why they put it on there. And there might have been some reluctance of the council at that time to sell that golf course without that caveat. It was an insurance policy. So if it is sold without the caveat on, Mr. Lawson, and he goes back to Canada. But generations of people in this community have experienced that as a golf course. And it, in my opinion, it would be a tragedy for this community to run the risk. That caveat's like an insurance policy is really what that is. And I know you're bringing up scary scenarios, but that's not, that's just speculation. Not necessarily true that it would revert back and weeds would grow or whatever you were saying. But that caveat's an insurance policy. That historical treasure will remain an icon of this community, and I think it's vitally important.
It is vitally important to the community. However, if you don't remove the caveat, it will, you'll lose it.
That's speculation.
That is speculation to a certain extent. But you're going to be rolling the dice one way or the other. Now, I've got three kids in this town. I've got a 10-year-old, one who just turned 6, one who just turned 4. I so dearly want to be playing golf with my children when I can't remember, when they're helping me go to the bathroom finally, okay? I want to do that. I mean, I want, I'm raising my children in this community, and I want the golf course for this community. And I, from the very bottom of my heart and soul, from my experience working at the golf course, what I know about the golf industry, what I've learned about the golf business, what I know specifically about Turquoise Valley, and what I feel from the very bottom of my heart as a pretty much a 20-year busy resident myself, the best chance for keeping this golf course in this community having the resource as it is and perhaps improving it for the community is to remove the caveat. Every sale dies with that caveat in place.
So people are, I don't understand. People are reluctant to buy that because that caveat's on, even though they want to continue it as a golf course. That's because they can't get money? Is that the problem? They can't get a bank loan? But I don't know if that's, I don't know if that's true or not. Is that true? Banks won't loan money to a golf course?
Let's put it this way. Banking has changed since the recession. Now, I'm not a banker, all right? I mean, what I know a lot of what I read from the industry journals, and I know a lot of what I learn a lot of what I do from talking to people. But banks don't loan money so freely as they used to, particularly not for golfing ventures. And they're not going to loan money willy-nilly to somebody who doesn't have a good plan or to somebody who can't actually back it up also. It's the insurance policy for the potential investor. As much as it was an insurance policy for the city of for the Newell family. Originally, the Newell family effectively donated it to the city of Bisbee in the 1930s to ensure that the land wouldn't be put to specious purposes. You know, there was a lot of money going around here. Now, that money is not going around here now. The only way to get a viable golfing interest, a viable interest to keep the golf course alive, is to remove, potentially harmful restrictions. I mean, if you want to get into a discussion of rhetoric, you could perhaps bring any potential purchaser down here to speak with you, during your term of mayor. But if you want to keep the golf course, you got to do this, and that's just it. I mean, that's the way I feel.
Okay, Mr. Carton, you want to say something? Why don't you come on up and get in the microphone so we know who you are, and the clerk's office knows what's going on later.
I can't get up.
Just a second.
Okay, Pete's trying to address some things, and you brought up the key question.
Push those closer to you if it's okay. Push those closer to you so it's okay so the clerk knows who's talking. Mr. Dave Carton again.
Is that right? Okay. 425 golf courses have closed in the United States in the last 5 years. The objective of the people who want to keep this course open is not to close it. Secondly, you have to ask yourself a question and think about some things. If it reverted back to the city, you're going to have half of an RV park, and you're going to have 10 and a half holes of withered grass. Mr. Durkin mentioned that if you shut down the irrigation system, it's going to dry out, you're going to have problems. You do not have an asset, you have a liability. No matter what you think of it, it's a liability at the current time because it's designed for a golf course. Secondly, or thirdly, if the golf course is going to survive, it's not going to be able to do it strictly on income from golf, because golfers are not as numerous as they used to be due to the economic downturn. I think you all know that. The secret to success is going to be to expand the RV park, to do more business in the restaurant and bar, and possibly to have some units that could be rented out, like casinos or things like that. And you're aware that all the land on the east side of the RV park belongs to the Lawsons. That land could be developed. It can be, the RV park could be expanded. You could build a little motel over there if you wanted to. You could have full facilities to make it a destination resort. But it has to be sold to somebody, if at all possible, from the community who believes in the opportunity here and wants to keep it as a golf course. And the banks will not loan money on that caveat. They can't do it. You could go out there and you could put $1 million into the purchase price and want to borrow $400,000 or $500,000. The bank will not loan you the money on that. The only money they will loan you is on the property that the Lawsons own, and the Lawsons will be trying to sell that. So it's a big conundrum there. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Councilmember Dowdy, did you have a question for somebody?
Pete.
Mr. Campbell?
I checked. You said that I was going to check out everything, which I did. I checked with the credit union, and in fact, I took a copy of the caveat over to them, and they said that they would loan money with that caveat on there. The only time they would not is if somebody, they said when people come in for a loan, they asked them what it is for. If they said it was for the golf course, they would loan them the money. If they wanted to use it for something else, you know, then the caveat would have to come off, of course. But they said, Shirley, do you want to buy the golf course? I said, oh, of course I do.
That might be
right.
Beneficial for a busy citizen who's interested in purchasing the golf course, but I don't really see that as being applicable to the reality of the situation.
Well, that's could be possible, yes, because, you know, I'm a hometown girl, so.
Like I said, I looked into it, too. I mean, but it got into the, you know, I'd be borrowing against money that I'd be borrowing. And really, all it would take is somebody who's got the initial investment down, and then that person could borrow against that investment, and, you know, that would be fine. But, you know, paying off two strangling mortgages, I guess you might say.
Yeah.
Well, let me clarify something. I do not want the golf course to revert to the city, but I want that caveat to remain. I think that is an insurance policy, not only for the people that live here now, but also for people 20, 40, 50, 60 years from now, not to lose this treasure. Some years ago, 15, 20 years ago, there was movements in Northern Virginia area to do lots of development, shopping malls and housing developments, and congressional people and concerned citizens across the political spectrum said, no, you don't want to lose these historic battlefields. This is a part of our past, part of our treasure of this country. That golf course is a part of the treasure of this community for generations of people that lived here. And so I will obviously, I want that caveat to remain. It's an insurance policy. Conversation of where the grass is going to turn brown, this is going to go out, that's speculation. That's all that is. That's like a scare tactic in a way. You don't know that's going to happen. So I think what the solution to this is Mr. Lawson should wait to, as a buyer that has enough capital that perhaps he doesn't need a bank loan, he can use that, he can borrow against other properties that he has, and has a buyer that has no problem having that caveat on. I have to respect the council from 1998 and on that put that caveat on. I think it was I think it was absolutely necessary that they do that. And so I'm pleased to, and I don't know how the vote on here, a vote tonight on the council is going to go, but I think that taking that caveat off, at some point in time, 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, that golf course won't exist. That's what I believe. So I am committed to keeping that caveat on. I think it's vitally important.
I believe me, I care very deeply about your opinion, and I agree very much with how important the golf course is to the community and how deeply I feel for the community too. Because I'm not just speaking as an employee, I'm speaking as a resident too. I fell in love with Bisbee before I knew about Turquoise Valley. But I believe we're working with a time limit here. The Peter and Leslie's visa time limit. Once that visa is up, they cannot own property in the United States. Or Peter, I think Peter believes he cannot own property. I was not at the work session where Peter actually spoke. I'm not sure exactly what questions were able to direct him then. I don't know with absolute certainty the things that he stated. However, I do think our best chance at having a golf course in the year to say by December 2017 is through the cabinet. And I also know that, I mean, I can't speak with absolute certainty. Maybe somebody from the Buffett family will come down and swoop down on gilded wings, and, you know, just to sell, or maybe I'll hit the lottery, you know. And if I do that, you know, the golf course will be owned by me. There will be a new Bisbee Foundation. I mean, streets will get, you know, and all these things, you know, could happen. But in my experiences, private investors aren't keen on rolling the dice like that, too. Now, what I've seen is a lot of people know of what the golf course was and know that, you know, the ownership under Lauren Brewer, Lauren did amazing things installing the irrigation on the front nine, installing the first 56 spaces to the RV park. But where it is now compared to where it was 18 years ago, it's light years improvement. It's now garnering interest in major, mid-major golfing organizations and people who truly know what they're doing and would not be placing themselves in a situation to use the golf course. And American citizens, or at least companies that have American backing, that would come in and actually not be subject to tedious visa renewals every 3 years or whatever it is. And I just, I could keep speaking, and you know, the merry-go-round can continue going around. But I've said my piece. I think the golf course has been an amazing move to the community. I think the work that Peter and Leslie Lawson have done has been outstanding. I don't think that we should potentially risk losing this important asset purely because a couple of people were amazing benefactors to the community. I mean, as much as I love them, I don't expect the people of Bisbee to give two picks for that. I expect the people of Bisbee to care about this resource that is theirs or that has been associated with Bisbee for this length of time, and it no longer is Bisbee's. But I think the best chance for the future of this golf course, given that it's owned by Canadians who are operating under imminently expiring visas, given that it's never easy to sell a golf course, even in the best of circumstances, has been in a recession of sorts that predated the United States with a global recession. And Bisbee, in and of itself, is that much further demographically challenged. Now, add up all those things, and the caveat is just over the covenant or the reversion class is kind of the straw that puts the camel's back in a lot of situations. And that's what I think.
Mayor.
Mr. Mayor, can I make one comment?
Of course. No, you don't have to. Come.
And before you make,
Mr. Dave Carton.
May I make just one more statement of the things that
You can make as many as you want.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Just real quick, but,
yeah.
You know, I've done some research in the local golf market and the international golf market. And as of, you know, as of fall of 2013, the city of Safford, in an effort to keep their golf course alive, was paying. The taxpayers of Safford were paying $16,000 a month to a group, an organization, to run that golf course. San Pedro Golf Course in Benson, that golf course was receiving $25,000 a month for 3 full years to keep it active and operating. Plus, there was $100,000 given to the city just to take it. In recent history, some sites is sometimes open, sometimes closed. Golf courses really are kind of going under, but they are still, and I think there's still some more fat to be trimmed, but I still think golf, you know, it's a wonderful pursuit, and it's great. You know, golfers live 5 years longer, there's a lot to say for it. And within the community of Bisbee, we have a very unique area where the golf course and the community can work hand in hand, they're mutually supportive. And Bisbee and Naco have had really a great deal. They've had a world-class golf course for the last several years without having to fund it from the taxpayers. And that's a real alternative, too. I mean, if Peter decides to not do the fire sale, it goes back to Bisbee. And rather than losing $60,000 a year for a nine-hole course, I heard that Benson was losing over $300,000 for their golf course. Now, if you keep me on as general manager, that ain't going to happen. But it's still, I mean, it's not a consideration that the taxpayers or the city council, I think, want to assume. It's a tricky proposition.
It is. I appreciate your comments, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Carton, Mr. Dave Carton.
Thank
again.
You, Mr. Mayor. I want to add one thing to what Pete said. I personally know that the Douglas Golf Course, which has been for sale for 2 years, is subsidizing it anywhere from $80,000 to $100,000 a month.
A month?
A month. Because they have 7 people in the grounds crew, they got a head groundskeeper, they have to keep people in the bar and the restaurant and everything, and they have no revenue coming in. They have an RV park down there in the parking lot, the pavement. It's got 34 spaces in it. There's another RV park on the east end of the course that has 88 RV spaces there, okay? And they're having trouble attracting people. But the main thing I want to say, and Ron, I have empathy with what you're saying, but you've got a conundrum here, okay? If it reverts back to the city, what does the city have? It has nothing more than a defunct piece of 100-acre land. It's not an operating golf course. It's going to take $1 million or so to put it back into place. It is no longer an asset to the city, Ron. It's a liability.
Well, perhaps we could sell it again with the caveat on. I'm joking.
You know, I know that the banks will not loan with that caveat on. I've been through that. Okay? And anyhow, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
I hope the council will make the right decision.
This is a... This has been a difficult decision, and I've thought about it for actually since about January. And it's a kind of an issue between personal private property and community concerns. I appreciate what Mr. Lawson has done there. And so it bothers me when I think of wanting to keep that caveat on, of punishing Mr. Lawson for being there, what, 18 years, is that what it is? And I've been out there for 3 events in the last month and a half or 2 months or so. It's beautiful. It's a magnificent place. And I don't want to lose it. And I don't want the city to have possession of it again, but I really don't want the caveat off either. So it's kind of a tough decision. But what I'm thinking of is I have to think of people in the community, generations that have been here and have been experienced and have experienced that golf course, and people in the future. And I don't want to say, or maybe somebody younger than me, I don't want to say 20, 30, 40 years from now, there used to be a golf course here. And this is where a lot of community events took place. I don't want to lose those things. And maybe I'm old-fashioned. I don't know. But I don't want to lose those things. I think it's important to hang on. And that caveat is an insurance policy. And all the statements that you're going to sell off all the equipment, well, he's going back to Canada. He's not going to be here, but we as a community, the generations of people that have lived here, we will remain, and their children and grandchildren and their great-grandchildren will still be here. And I think it's important. It's something, I don't want to say a spiritual thing, but it's a community connect to the people that live here and make this place a special place. And that's why I do not want that caveat off. I think it's just absolutely imperative that we keep it on. Councilmember Hansen.
He keeps saying that there is a concern of the community, but I've received several emails, and listening to the people here tonight, I haven't heard anybody stand up and object to it. So where are all these objections coming from? And why aren't they here to voice their objections?
Well, I can tell you that I've heard them privately, okay? Lots of them.
Mayor?
Councilmember Klein.
Well, Ms. Carl has been wanting to say something, so...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Me after her.
City Attorney Ann Carl.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. I just wanted to make one quick point that when you transfer property, you're transferring a bundle of rights and privileges. And in this case, property was transferred to us without a certain right. And the caveat that was transferred to us was a caveat that we transferred to someone else, right? So I guess I'm just speaking to any members of the council who would wish to remove this caveat. And that is to, if you're going to make a motion to remove the caveat, that you add your own caveat to that motion, which would say, so long as the council, to its satisfaction, receives assurances from the successors and assigns of the NACO Real Estate and Improvement Company, and receives those through the Turquoise Valley Golf Course. That would put the burden on the Turquoise Valley Golf Course to speak with members of the Hughes family, members of the Newell family, and get assurances for us that they're not going to come after us for removing the caveat that this company way back in the 30s put on the city. Does that make sense? So, you know, in a perfect world, we would gather all those people together, those successors and assigns, and I don't know who they are. I went onto the website of the Arizona Corporation Commission looking for those people, and I couldn't even find the name of this corporation anymore on the website. So I don't want the city to have the burden, the legal burden, of having to go up to the Arizona Corporation Commission and to figure out who are all these people. And I don't want them to have to redeed the property to the city, but I'm thinking perhaps affidavits from as many people as we can, as Turquoise Valley can find, people who would attest to wanting this removed for the city as well. Do you see what I'm saying?
It's a mayor.
I hope you
don't. No.
Okay. So. The reason why the golf course wants to have the caveat removed by you is so that when they deed the property to someone else, they don't have to have the caveat on that deed.
Well, I understand that.
Okay, now go in reverse. You are talking about removing the caveat for them, but this deed that you have, that the quitclaim deed that the city got, includes the caveat for the city, which means that the bundle of rights and privileges and responsibilities includes this caveat that we got and that we then transferred. So I would like to see some assurances from the successors and assigns of this company that transferred the property to us in the first place, saying that they... saying to our satisfaction that they will not try to enforce this restriction on our original deed. That makes sense?
Getting closer.
Okay.
Does the council understand this?
Okay. The original deed says that the property will go back to the NACO Real Estate and Improvement Company if the restrictions are violated, okay? So that company isn't in existence anymore, but the family members, the two members of the Hughes family showed up at the
work session.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And you know, I see on the original deed the acting secretary was John S. Hughes. Well, okay, and the president was John Newell. Were there other families that were a part of that company? I don't know. Hopefully not. Hopefully it's just the Newells and, you know, the brother-in-law, the Hugheses. But I just want to make sure that the city's interests are protected, that somebody isn't going to come out of the woodwork and say, we want to enforce that covenant against the city. Yes.
Councilmember Hansen.
So basically what you're saying is you want to make sure that someone from the Newell family does not come back and say that we wanted to enforce that caveat, that we need to have something signed that says that they're releasing them from the caveat also?
Right.
Okay.
You know, something to the council's satisfaction, and it may be when the county takes over for your legal services, the county will say, hey, let's just roll the dice and we'll see what happens. I don't know, you know. I'm just trying to be risk averse here, and I would recommend that you just add a caveat yourselves if you plan on supporting this removal of the other caveat.
Councilmember Dowdy?
The Newell family did say that they would remove the caveat.
They did, but I don't think it's in writing yet, is it?
Pardon?
I don't think
not
it's
to
in
my
writing.
Knowledge.
It's not in writing, no, but they did say that at their work session.
I received a letter from the Newells in writing stating that they would remove that caveat from the city of Bisbee if we removed it from the Lawsons.
From Susan Ridgway, is this the one you're talking about?
Vote on this. Can we vote on this, please?
Yeah, we certainly can. I'm done speaking. Councilmember Klein?
Okay. Well, first of all, Pete, I wish you would win the lottery and take it over, because then we know for a fact that everything would be protected. I think because we know how much hard work you put in day in and day out, and we very much appreciate it. And Lauren Brewer, boy, that I hadn't heard that name in a long time, but is the only council member up here, I guess, that had to deal with this the first time. And I said this to Mr. Lawson at our work session. I certainly understand his position and what, you know, the pickle that he's in. But, you know, this isn't any easier now than it was back then. And I'll tell you what, when we did sell the golf course, we were... I'm not going to say we were threatened, but we were put in a very bad spot, and it was very uncomfortable, and the people of Bisbee were extremely displeased with us. And we did hear about it for many years. However, you know, moving forward, I think that Pete and Leslie do have the right, and they would start selling off piece by piece. So we're back in another conundrum again. However, with the Hughes family saying, I don't think we have it in a legal writing, that they will remove the caveat. And at the time that, you know, this originally came before us, they wouldn't. So, I mean, I think that helps make a decision now. But with Ms. Carl bringing up the issues that she brought up, that adds a whole other layer. I don't know. I think it would help if we kind of knew maybe who the potential buyers or investors, so we could, you know, kind of maybe get, you know, some reassurance that they'll abide by, you know, by what we put forth.
Mr. Mayor, I have a legal question.
Yes, go up to the podium, please. Mr. Carton.
We
question is, when they, what did you call it, the NACO Real Estate Company?
The NACO Real Estate and Improvement Company.
When they gave up that corporation, was it a corporation?
It was.
Okay, so do the people who were stockholders or owners of that corporation have rights anymore once that company folded?
Well, sometimes it's in the, you know, the dissolution documents about, you know, the assets going to the successors and assigned.
After listening to everything, is that would be a big legal question, and I don't think anybody can say tonight that the members who own that corporation did not give up their right. I don't think you can say that. That's just my opinion, but I haven't heard that.
All I'm suggesting is that if you do vote tonight, you add a caveat of your own, contingent upon receipt to the council's satisfaction of written assurances that this restriction won't be enforced against the city, ultimately.
Mayor?
Councilmember Dunn.
Certainly, I very strongly support removing this caveat and contingent on receiving approval from the original families. The caveat, again, states very clearly, will be used solely and exclusively as a golf course. I can't imagine that anyone would want to spend $1 million on this property and then immediately plow it under. That doesn't make any sense. You and I, a month or two ago, had the opportunity to meet with the mayor's meeting at the golf course country club at Douglas. And it certainly indicates what might be possible with this property. As someone indicated, a development of a destination resort. Certainly Douglas, it's interesting we're discussing this as we were also looking at this the Urban Land Institute coming down and looking at housing mix. Certainly Douglas is similar to us in terms of having a large amount of excess fixer-up homes that aren't selling. But at the same time, as you drive by that property in Douglas, you see a huge development. You see alternative housing that has developed with reference to because that golf course is there. And I think options like that are certainly what needs to be considered by a developer in terms of how can we use the remaining property that is owned outright by the Lawsons and able to better capitalize on this golf course. It would be a shame to divide that up. For sure that's not going to happen. It's going to be divided up. We'd be back like stated, other communities who are trying to operate their own golf course. Only is going to be successful if this is part of a larger development. So however we want to word this in terms of obviously that we would remove the caveat contingent on receiving legal authority or from the family to do the same. But the caveat is, it's not just to stop using it as a golf course, it is to be solely and exclusively used as a golf course, which prevents literally anything else other than a golf course. And I think we're just dead in the water under that caveat. So we've got to open this up. It could really be a boom to this community, to doing what we're all talking about here, really developing this property as a golf course. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from the council? Councilmember Sullivan.
Thank you, Mayor. The caveat in question was placed on Turquoise Valley Golf Course by the Newell family when they donated it to the City of Bisbee in the 1930s in order to ensure the property would remain a golf course. Since then, the City of Bisbee sold the golf course to the Lawsons for $4,000 with the caveat still in place. The Lawsons have diligently invested in the improvement of the golf course, making it the renowned tourist attraction and community convention center that it is today. We know that the Lawsons have been trying to sell the golf course with the caveat in place for the last 6 years, but because of the caveat, they've watched their deals disintegrate. We can clearly see that Mr. and Mrs. Lawson, Peter Campbell, and all the many local and visiting tourists, visiting Turquoise Valley patrons have vested interest in protecting the continuation of Turquoise Valley as a golf course. And we all have that same interest in mind, of course. And I think that we would be foolish not to remove this caveat, because we know for a fact that they want to sell everything off if we can't take this caveat off. They don't want to wait anymore. They've been waiting 6 years, and with the way that the changes have happened in the banking industry, it just doesn't look good for the golf course if we don't remove that caveat. It seems like we're putting up a barrier to letting it continue on as a golf course. And if we want to keep it the jewel and the community asset and the revenue source that it is, we really have to be proactive and not let the Lawsons sell off all the equipment and the clubhouse and everything that makes it a golf course. We know for a fact that they want to do that. We don't know for a fact that the buyers, the potential buyers, are going to turn around and turn it into something else. We don't know that, but we do know that the Lawsons have stated they're going to start selling off their assets. And we don't have a lot of time. They said they don't want to wait around, like you said, Mr. Mayor, and hang loose. They've been hanging loose for 6 years. They want to retire. They want to go back to Canada. And we need to move on this. We need to look at the repercussions if we don't. And I think we're really going to be disappointed in the outcome on many levels if we don't remove this caveat.
Thank you. Any other comments from the council?
Mayor, I move that we cooperate with Lawson's in appropriately removing this caveat on the talk on that Turquoise Valley Golf Course, stating that the property shall be used solely and exclusively as a golf course. And that certainly would be contingent on receiving legal confirmation from the Newell family that, in essence, removing us from that caveat. I'm not sure whether I've stated that correctly.
That's fine. I second it.
We have a motion and a second. On this item, Ms. Williams, I need a roll call vote.
Councilmember Connors?
Aye.
Councilmember Hansen?
Aye.
Councilmember Dowdy?
Aye.
Mayor Pro Tem Klein?
Aye.
Councilmember Dunn?
Aye.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Aye.
Mayor Early?
Nay. Motion passes 6-1. Item number 17 already. Discussion and possible approval to allow Mayor and Council to go into an agreement between Arizona Department of Homeland Security for operation of Stone Garden Award number 130415-03 and the Police Department in the amount of $9,000 for equipment with the use of reallocated funds awarded to the Bisbee Police Department. Sergeant Bobby Coronado. Yeah. Any questions or comments from the council? Do we have a motion?
I move to allow the mayor and council to go into an agreement between Arizona Department of Homeland Security for Operation Stone Garden Award number 130415-03 and the Police Department in the amount of $9,000 for equipment specifically to purchase two tri-band interoperable compatible. Boy, it's late in the evening. With the use of reallocated funds awarded to Bisbee Police Department.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Sergeant Coronado. Next, we have the City Manager's Report, Mr. Justin Johnson.
Thank you, Mayor. Very, very quickly, I want to just take a minute to acknowledge Joe Ward, who recently passed his commercial building inspection certification. So we're very happy with that. You have in front of you a little postcard acknowledging today is Arizona Gives Day. So you have up until 11:59 this evening, kind of a one-day a fundraising event, and one of our community partners, Arizona Workforce, has asked that we support their particular efforts, and they've certainly been very beneficial in us as we go out and try to recruit and hire employees. The City of Bisbee Police Public Works Department received a donation from KENG for a swing arm winch that's permanently placed at the Mule Gulch lift station. The Arizona Debt Shutoff Program has netted just over $12,000. Very excited about that. You go, girl. And the ancillary benefit is that it spurred some activity from other folks in the community that do not want to be a part of this program, and they've come in. So we've also seen about $20,000 increase in the amount of owed sewer fees, and so we're very excited about that. And so, and Mayor, that's all I have. On Thursday we have our budget workshop.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The ayes have it. This meeting is adjourned.